Okay. We're going to work through this morning again. If anyone does not have one of the Imam Rakamas things, it's definitely kedai to make sure you do have one, because we're going to be working with them today. And you also probably will and should, you know, want to be able to have one with you as the years go on. We, as the title of the Imam Rakamas implies, this is going to be a practical guide to the kashrus of the Arba Minim. And we're going to focus not necessarily on all of the details of all of the halachas that are there, but we definitely are going to focus on the things that are actually nogei lamaisa, the things that are relevant, that come up, that happen, that you will for sure encounter. So you can have like a pretty, you know, pretty decent exposure to some of the issues that are relevant. Now, this year provides you with an opportunity that you might not have totally had in the past, and that's why it's incredibly important to make sure to actually have a pretty decent grasp on what we're doing over here this morning. For sure, for you right now, gone are the days where you order the Arba Minim set from the shul, and they tell you it's like the most nice and greatest possible set of Arba Minim, for the low price of whatever it is that's there. But like this year, you're actually going to have to purchase a Dalet Minim for yourselves. Here in Eretz Yisrael, largely, almost across the boards, the ideas of, getting a, full, complete set delivered to your, doorstep doesn't really exist. And for good reason, because the truth is, that's really not the way to get something that is, that actually really is, totally fine and up to par. What you are going to be doing, though, is buying your Dalet Minim one at a time. Now, of course, one at a time means eventually you want to get to a total of four that you have. Like, when you get all four of them, then you know that you're going to be good. But here you're so on your own that even simple little things like having the kloshikol, like having the little holder that you put everything in, is like a separate purchase that doesn't necessarily come with the Dalet Minim. All the different rings are things that you're going to have to, like, put, together by yourselves. Like, it's a very, like, do-it-yourself kind of a country when it comes to Arba Minim. The truth be told, that so, some people have just the Dalet Minim might even just grow in their backyards. So it can be very do-it-yourself. You can pluck them off trees and snip off branches, and it's a whole different experience when you're doing that. But lamaisa, you are going to be buying Dalet Minim, and therefore it becomes important to actually know what it is that you are doing. We also, as Bnei Torah and Bnei Yeshiva, have an opportunity to be able to try now to get a chance to know things as best as we can, and buy things that really are muhudarim, and really are as great as they possibly can. Now, one very, very simple rule that we're going to start off with before we continue. Oftentimes in the world of halacha, when trying to be mekayim a mitzvah, there is a certain tension that's there between the world of theoretical possibility and the world of practical possibility. Meaning, a person can, even if he's a bucky in all of the halachas and knows exactly what a perfect, uses as an example, perfect set of Dalet Minim is all about, the practical side though says a couple of things. Number one, you have to actually be able to find out there in the market a place to be able to purchase and access the things that are as nice as you think you know all about and would possibly like. The second difficult part that can be there, and it's a real thing, and definitely has to be factored in 100%, are the financial limitations of what is available. In other words, if you're going to buy, like the nicest, whatever it's going to be, that's going to cost you much, much more than something that's a little bit more, maybe even kasher lechatchila, basically muhudr, but might not be the best thing that's there, but it's going to be more moderately priced, and something that might be, more affordable. And things can cost a heavy penny when you're in like the more major league kind of ballpark. What we're going to be trying to do over here is to explain what it is that you have to know, but also with the sensitivity to some of the cost issues that exist. Now, we know that this is only really part one of a two-part series of halachas of Dalet Minim. Meaning to say, part one is all this morning. Okay, so that we're here for, like, there's going to be a break in the middle. Don't worry. Okay, but we are here up until whenever lunch might end up being today. But part two is going to be the day after Yom Kippur, Beis Hashem, together as a, I don't know if it's a group, because everyone sort of comes on their own, because they're already Bein Hazmanim, but as a like group that's coming from all over the place, we're going to be visiting the main Dal Minim Shuk in Yerushalayim, in the, what's called Zupnik off of Kikar Shabbos, and there, you're going to be able to put all the things that you're learning this morning to the test of practicality. You're going to send you out amongst hundreds of wild and untamed lulavim in their almost natural environment. They're not really in trees anymore, but they're sitting, they're not even caged, these things. They're just out and loose and exposed, and you're going to have to come back with a, what do you call it, capturing a beautiful set of Dali meaning for yourself, past the scrutinous eyes of myself and Harry Greenwald, and be told, okay, you know, where were you sleeping when we spoke about this? Why did you do this? Or, unbelievable, that was great. How did you do that? Well, what great eyes you have, and you really must have grasped, you know, all the, what do you call, all the relevant dinim that are there. But that really becomes like a very, very great opportunity, and I can't emphasize enough how great of an opportunity that is, but a great, 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 great opportunity to actually, like, learn the halach issues in a very, very hands-on kind of a way. Again, for those of you who have been there before, you know, you're a little bit more aware. For those who are not, but the chance to be able to, you know, to be walking around and, you know, again, here in Eretz Yisrael, you're allowed. I might be from Chutzlars. I just haven't been there for a very long time. But you're definitely allowed to take things away from the, you know, the seller without buying them and have them inspected by a rabbi. If you don't like it, bring it back. You know, try again. There's a lot of trust, which is, you know, mikam chayisol. It really is an amazing thing that. And that people, you know, will let you do that, and so you have the opportunity to really, you know, walk around, be finding different things, and trying your best, you know, to inspect, to look and see what you think, you know, the kashrus and worth of something is. And then, you know, to put that into practice. And of course, part of our job when we're going to be there, the Dalim Minim Shuk, is to help make sure the cost is something that actually is doable. So a question is also going to be, well, how much do they want for that particular lulav or eserg, whatever it might be? And then, you know, to gauge whether or not it's actually, you know, a worthwhile investment, or maybe recommend to the guy to bring the price down, which is also something that you're allowed to do here, you know, and negotiate and try to come to whatever maskan you're going to have. Now, that being said, let us begin. Let us begin. We're going to start off with the halachas. I'm just going to go in order, actually, the way things are. It makes my life easier. Hey. That's not true. Hold on a second. This is not in order. Let my thing go, please. Hold on. Sorry. Two should come after one, right? Where is it? Let's come up in here. I got five. I'll figure this out. I'll figure out one of the pages as we go. Oh, it's fine. No problem. Okay. The, you don't know, just bought one of these. It was in book-like form, but it got a little butchered. Yeah. I'm going to just use one of these, and it will be good. Hopefully I can actually read this. And let's, okay. Now we're going to start off with a lulav, because contrary to popular belief, lulavim are actually the most difficult things to get, to get really, really right and really, really okay. So we're going to walk through and spend a lot of time on learning the dinim of a lulav. Okay. Now let me just actually more comment before we actually start. Be aware also that you know, two more things about the idea of price and the chatchila, you know, kashrus. The range of prices, how much these things actually cost, is mind-boggling. It's like extremely, extremely, extremely big. You can buy a set of dalaminim that really is basically l'chadchila, but basically kasher, that you wouldn't be making a, you know, total bracha vatala for very, very cheap. Like, you can get things that are like really, really, really inexpensive. Please keep in mind the prices are in shekels and not in dollars, right? So when you speak about, you know, I got everything for 50 shekel, which you could do, and you translate that into like divide by four into the dollar range, it's like, that's like really cheap. Like, even in the cheapest, you know, shul backyard sale that you had at home, like, it's probably not going to be that cheap. So it's not going to be that nice, but you can get things that really, really are very cheap if need be. And on the other hand, like on the expensive range is like very, 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 very expensive. We're talking about thousands of shekels to, you know, for d'aluminium. And that's like a whole different ballpark that's there. And so when we speak about like trying to make sure like things are aligned, nothing you're gonna see in the shuk is gonna be in that kind of a price range on the higher end. But there really is like a whole like big, you know, massive world that's there. We're going to try to, you know, to bridge the gap, you know, in between to make sure we come out okay. Now, that being said, let us begin, and we go like this. We're going to speak about number one here is a psul of something called a kafaf, a lulav that is bent over. Zokev kefufim. Hashem, right, straightens out the people that are bent over. So kafaf is also a psul when it comes to lulav. Now what we're going to be doing over here, I'm not going to read all of the Mishnah Berurahs and things inside, but what I did want you to have, and the Mishnah Berurahs are all, Shulchan Aruch Mishnah Berurahs all in these little, they used to be gray boxes, and I don't know what color it is anymore, with a lot of years of photocopying, and like funky angles and all that I see also. Wow, it's just like exciting today. But the, that's fine, I agree, it's good. We're good. So if you have a chance on your own, like to actually be able to look up the halachas and see, you know, see where things are at, this happens to be a, you know, a very, very decent, you know, if I do say so myself, a very decent guide to actually, you know, being aware of what the issues actually are. Okay, so there's a psul called kafaf, if the lulav is bent. Now, when you look in the Shulchan Aruch is very, very clear that a lulav is only pasul. Kafaf is only going to pass the lulav if what's called the shedra, the spine of the lulav, is bent over. If the leaves are bent, so that lulav is still going to be kosher. So, for example, I'm using a an old lulav. This lulav has many, many issues with it. This probably used to be fairly expensive, but right now is, you know, fairly worthless. But let us begin. Some of the things, you know, might be obvious to us, but I want to make sure they're clear to everybody. This part, like the wood part of the lulav that runs straight up the middle, that's called a shedra. That's called the spine of the lulav. Called that because that's what it is. It's the spine of a lulav. Okay? Now, the lulav, the spine, I should say rather, eventually ends. Okay, let me just get you an end of a spine over here. I think those are pretty high. The spine eventually ends, and then you just have the, what I'm going to call the leafy area of the lulav. But the spine basically goes up until where that split is. That's really where, like, you know, might end a little bit before that, but right basically over there. That whole wooden part of the lulav. Now, according to the Mechaber, if that, well, don't try this on one of your lulav that you're going to buy, but if that spine was actually like bent over, like in that kind of a shape, like physically bent, that would have been possible. The leaves on the top of the lulav, if the leaves are going to be bent over, I'm going to like use my fingers like this, and looking, you know, sort of like that, that is going to be kosher according to the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch. I noted over here that the Mishnah Berurah brings the name of the Rush, that the Rush held a very interesting sheet. The Rush held that he felt that was the most mahudr lulav you can possibly get, is when the leaves of the lulav are bent over in that kind of a fashion. The Rush held that because if that was true, the leaves, when the lulav is shaped like that, the top leaves can never split apart. They're like pretty much like there, you know, solid in place. This is a nice picture over here of a lulav where the top of the lulav, where the leaves are bent over in a way that that they're really just like, that's it. They ain't going anywhere, those leaves, like that. And this actually is not uncommon to see a lulav that looks, you know, more or less, you know, like that. You can have like, again, a shape like this. That's something in the next picture that's there, where it's not as pronounced, the you know, the bend that's there in those leaves. That's a little bit more common, something like you just saw. But that's something that actually really, really does happen. However, not so quick, the Chafetz Chaim does bring in the Mishnah Berurah that there are some, I shouldn't say some, there are many Rishonim who feel that the halach is not like what the Shulchan Aruch said. And they held that if the leaves alone are bent on the lulav, not the shedra, but if the leaves alone are bent on the lulav, that lulav actually becomes pasul, becomes totally pasul, totally invalidated, and that would not be would not be good. Now, the Chafetz Chaim does say that the minhag ha'olam, the common practice, is to follow the kula, to follow the leniency of the Shulchan Aruch. That if you have a lulav with leaves bent on the top, people will use that, make a bracha on that, etc. However, since there is a machlokas about that, and you have, again, the two extremes are exactly that. They're extreme, right? The Rush will tell you that's like a great lulav to use, and many of the Rishonim say that lulav is totally possible. So sometimes we like, I shouldn't say sometimes, we would always like, in theory, to avoid getting into, you know, controversial kinds of situations where, you know, to some this is totally good and to others this is totally bad. It definitely recommended, as much as a person can, to make sure that the leaves on the lulav are going to be totally straight all the way up until the top of the lulav, to make sure that things are not bent or not bent over. Again, no one can come and say your lulav is pusel if it's bent like that, but it's definitely advisable, definitely extremely smart, to try to make sure that that is not the case. However, if one is of Hasidish background, or one is of not even more than that, some Rebbish kind of background, and some people are like that, so many of the Hasidish Rebbes were makbid to take, like the Rush, to take a lulav, what's called Ninish, a knepel. A knepel means exactly that. This guy over here, the little hook that's there on top, and a lulav with a knepel is a very common Hasidish thing to use. And so if one Davka has that practice, then they, you know, what do you call it? You know, definitely should and could continue to follow that. If that is not one, you know, one particular clear minhag to say that we go out of our way to take a lulav with a knepel, so then we should try to avoid using that. Just by the way, I didn't say this before, but since like our first like Yiddish word and terminology came up over here, in the world of mitzvahs, there are many like phrases that are used in conjunction with various mitzvahs. So Dalet Minim have a lot of like Yiddish words that are universally used when you refer to different parts of the Dalet Minim. It's advisable to try to get to know those words also, so you can sound intelligent if you're speaking to somebody about about your Dalet Minim. Okay, that's relatively easy, straightforward, and again, like we said, literally, the lulav should try to be straightforward if you can, and that's really not all that hard to find, but you will see plenty of lulav that have the bend on top, and that's something number one that you're going to want to try to look out for. Number two, this one confuses the daylights out of everybody every year, all the time. Even very trained people who have a little bit more familiarity with Dalet Minim get this one messed up a lot. And it's something that you have to get used to. And it sounds very, very surprising to people at first. And that's called the psul of a hemnik. A hemnik. Now, what is a hemnik? The hemnik does not have a translation into English, so we're going to describe what the halacha is about a hemnik. Now, what was that? No. What was that? Come again?
Bent like a sickle?
No, not exactly. Let's talk. I just forgot. You just finished up. You're supposed to know all this stuff. Okay, but let's go like this. You have. Let's see. I'm just going to turn this around for a second so I can just get the appropriate part. There is something on a lulav called a tiyomis. So the tiyomis is a phrase that you might be familiar with. The tiyomis is the what we're going to call the middle upper leaf of the lulav. Now, just to show you what I did over here, when you want to identify where the tiyomis is, and a lot of halachas about a lulav are going to revolve around that tiyomis. Now, there happens to be a running machlokas between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah about the significance of that middle leaf. But the bottom line is that we do place a real significance on that tiyomis. And what a person is going to do when he wants to look at a lulav. So first off, you should take a look and see if it look basically straight. Okay, most of the time they are. Sometimes the lulav can be bent off. If you were to look, for example, over age, I keep lulavim always by my door. There's a school that I keep lulavim by the front door of your house, so we keep most of our lulavim there all year round. And so over time, just getting sitting against like a wall, they'll just sort of like when they dry out, like is it like if you imagine if you were leaning against the wall all year, you would dry out eventually and just be sort of stuck in that like I'm leaning against the wall position. So that's what happened to this guy. But this is actually not, in case you didn't know, this is not straight. You got that? Not straight. Now, in theory, if we could do a little surgery over here, lulav guy would be straight. I don't know if that's really straight either, but we look something along like that. Now, first thing you take, take a look, make sure the lulav looks like straight. Okay, most of the time they do. You're going to take your your hands and you're going to try to go to where you see the top of the shedra is, where the top of the spine is. And then you ever so gently, you don't have to be so gentle, but it's good to be gentle at the start unless you know what you're doing, you start to peel away the leaves until you see where, let me try to turn this around piece by piece, until you start to see where the shedra is ending. And the spine eventually, you know, goes up, and you notice that there are two leaves off to the side. You can peel those one away also. And then you'll see that there's really one leaf that comes out of the middle of the shedra, and that's going to be called your tiyomis. Now, there's a number of halachas that are going to be unique to that tiyomis. We're going to point them out as they come up. A hemnik is one of them. What a hemnik basically means is as follows. And again, this is like a tricky description. I'm going to show you some pictures also, so we can see some real live hemniks here. What a hemnik is when the top leaf of the lulav, on the very, very top. Again, new Yiddish word that you have to know, the spitz. The spitz means the top, the point of the lulav. When the spitz of the lulav, again, I'd like to make it clear. We're going to learn soon about what everyone's favorite lulav issue, which is one of the, like, not such a big issue either, about when the tiyomis is split, when the two leaves are not together. Even if the leaves are together, you know, the leaves are glued together and they're totally normal and fine. At the very, very top, at the very spitz of the lulav, it can happen that the two leaves are, they look like they're going apart from each other, that they're split apart from one another. So let me use my finger just to give you a little demonstration. Okay, this is like one of these like karate things over here. Let's say you have this, okay? Now, these two fingers, I think you can see it from this side. If I could do that, I would show you it's a little bit better on this side, I think. But these two fingers, the tops, the little tips of my two fingers are, in theory right now, like perfectly aligned with each other. Okay, if this would be a tiyomis of a lulav, this would be pretty nice. It would look a little funny because it looks like fleshy and like a finger, but if this was a tiyomis, that would be pretty okay. Imagine though for a second, the tiyomis did like this. It split open in a way that it, you can see, I don't know if you can see it from there, but the two leaves are growing slightly apart from each other. And there's a little V at the top. You see where that is? Like that? Yeah? So that would be called a hemnik. Now, if you want an extreme, if you do this, right, that would be like, whoa, that's really bad. That's for sure a hemnik, and there's like nothing to talk about. And there you got a problem, okay? But that is a hemnik. Now, a hemnik is a puzzle. 3 points we made over here on the thing. Even if it is totally natural, the lulav grew like that, the leaves are like that, it doesn't really matter, the hemnik is puzzle. If the tiyomis is split even minutely, in other words, if there's like a very, 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 very small little break in the tiyomis in a way that is really, totally, totally kosher in theory in terms of the tiyomis being glued together. But if the two leaves are going to look like they branch off in two different directions, that lulav becomes a puzzle. Number three, I pointed out, this is a fairly common occurrence. And what that really means is it happens a lot. And it's very easy to find a hemnik. This isn't one of those things that they guarantee. There's going to be a number of you are going to bring back a lulav for us to look at. And we're going to say, here's a hemnik. Everyone's going to go, whoa, what are you talking about? And if you look at it carefully, you'll get used to, oh, yeah, you know what? I see that, right? That's a hemnik. It's the kind of a thing that when you look at a lulav from afar, you just look at a lulav sitting on a table, you might not have noticed. You have to pick it up and look at it. Again, if you can only see that the hemnik through a magnifying glass, through whatever it is, that doesn't qualify. You can always see them with the naked eye, but they at times, you know, are not as obvious as we would have thought. So let's show some examples over here. Yeah, if they're visibly two things, then we're gonna have a problem. Now, in picture number one, right over here, this is like a mega clear extreme example of a hemnik, and this actually is not so common. Where you see there's two leaves and they just like are growing, separately from each other, that is not an incredibly common thing. You see what I'm talking about? Where it's actually so obvious you might not see it. There's a leaf here, and a leaf here. Wow, that's a good idea. Have to put on the glasses. Yeah? Okay? So these two leaves are totally growing apart from each other. That's like a very, very bad example, like a bad hemnik. That's a problem. You can have an example like this. This you're not going to see from afar, but here's an example of a hemnik that is extremely common. And without like looking at and knowing what you're looking at, like understanding what your eyes are supposed to be trained to see, you know, you could totally miss that kind of an example of a hemnik. Again, I can't describe to you how common that actually is. It really does happen. It is very, very common. And something that you're going to want to be looking out for when you're buying your, you know, when you're buying your Dalet Minim.
What was the third common sin? They're on the list.
Even if it's natural, it doesn't have to be that it got broken like that. If it grew like that, it's still going to be puzzle. Number two, even if it's just like a small little bit, as long as you can see it with your eye, that becomes a hemnik. And again, it is something that's popular. Like, it sounds strange when you first hear about this, but it's something that happens like very, you know, very, really very often. Okay. Next example of something that that comes up on a lulav. This one people are a little bit more familiar with, but let's work through how the halachas actually work and what to be looking at.
I thought you said there were three common mistakes.
One, two, and three.
Even if it grew like that, right? That's one.
Yeah, so second next thing, it's two.
Second one is that even if it's a little bit, what's the third?
And just to realize that it's a common thing that this happens like all the time. It's something that like people just like mess up at a like just lack of awareness of what they're looking at. Everything can look like really, really nice. Like, oh, it was green and it's big and it's blah, 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 blah. And that one little thing on top like can pass the entire thing. Just no good, nothing to talk about, and the whole thing becomes bad. Okay. The next example, the next thing I want to speak about is something that is more common. No, I shouldn't say more common. People are more familiar with. But it certainly does happen. It certainly is pretty common also. And that's what's called nechlaka hatiyomer. So that tiyomer, so that top leaf of the lulav is split into. As we know, when lulav trees grow, so the lulavs are all the branches of the lulav are all a combination of two different leaves that are glued together by a natural glue. So let's say if I take this leaf over here and I peel it away from the bag, I can rip it into two, because every single lulav has two leaves that are glued together. If they don't have that, the Mishnayos, the Gemaras really like indicate that the and Brona Shulchan Aruch that the lulav will become possible. But they grow. That is the way the lulav leaves will grow. Now nechlaka tiyomis means if that middle leaf is split into two, that creates a what do you call it? That creates more of a problem than the leaves being split in other areas. Now, Lamaisa, the Ramah Paskins over here, it's in Tav Reish Mem Hei, the Ramah Paskins that Lechatchila, the Tiyomis, that upper leaf has to be entirely closed right up until the top. It should not be split in two in any way, shape, or form. It should be closed, glued together, and that is it. Now, that's a Lechatchila. To make a lulav puzzle, on the other hand, the split has to be that the top middle leaf is split all the way down to the shedra, that the entire leaf is split from start to finish. That means, just to make it clear, that it is very, very hard, it's very difficult to find a lulav that is actually puzzle because the tiyomis is split. Because unless it's split all the way down to the bottom, the lulav is actually not puzzle. So let's say, for example, somebody bought a lulav, right? And they thought it was really, really great, and they go home and they notice that there was a split down the tiyomis. Says, hey, you know, I don't want that, and whatever it was. And it was a big split, right, down the tiyomis. You have a right, in general, if you bought something and like a rub showed you was puzzle or whatever it would be, you have a right to return to get your money back and trade in for something else. That's totally legitimate to do. But in this particular example, unless that split was all the way down to the shedra, the truth be told, it is kosher, and you wouldn't have a right to go back and, you know, and switch that or get your money back. No refunds, no reimbursements for that. Like, the bottom line is, it is kosher. You are allowed to make a bracha on that, and that is okay. So it's a good idea to try to like be careful and look at that from the start, because otherwise you'll get into some tricky things. Now, let's get a couple other points. I'm going to take all the questions. Within those two extremes, the chatchila should be fully closed B'diyeved, according to the Ramaz says, it's only possible if it goes all the way down to the bottom. There's a number of other opinions that are there about this psul of Nechlaka Hatiyom. So, for example, the Mishnah Berurah brings down that many of the poskim say that Mitzad Hadin, it doesn't have to be split all the way to the Shedra to be possible, but if Rov of the Tiyomis is split, that is also going to be possible. There's a principle, Rubo Kikulo, and the majority is split, it's like it's all split, and many of the poskim felt that that's enough to make a lulav possible. So if you have the lulav where the Tiyomis is Rov split into, even though it doesn't get all the way down to the bottom, so that would be a little bit more of a shayla. Do you have a right to give that back? Again, the bottom line is the Mishnah Berurah's achra is that does passel a lulav. So if a person, a lulav seller, was being like, you know, very, you know, straight and honest, he would be understanding that, you know, like, yeah, the bottom line is that's really not something you would want to make a brach on, because the bottom line is the Mishnah Berurah says that is passel. On the other hand, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that still is going to be kasher. Now, there's a shita that says that even a mashu, this is quoted by the Rama also, even a mashu, even a little split in the tiyomis is enough to make, even if a little split is there in the tiyomis is enough to make the lulav pasul not usable. Now, that's obviously much more machmer. Even a little split would be possible. That's only a hiddur. In other words, we're not saying mi'ikar adin, but what do you call it? L'chatchili, you definitely want the lulav to be totally, totally closed. The Taz has a fourth shita. The Taz's shita is that in order for the tiyomes to be puzzle, it has to be that it was split a tefach length. Not a little bit, but a tefach. And until the tiyomes is split a tefach, so then it's still going to be kosher. Now, that means, as I pointed out over here in the bullet, a very, very simple cheshbon. If you have two lulavim in front of you, and one is the tiyomis split a little bit, and one is the tiyomis split up until, what do you call it, a little bit more than a tefach, it's definitely better to... let's go the opposite. If you have a lulav that has a bigger split, and a lulav that has like a tefach length split, so then it's obviously better to use the lulav that the split is going to be smaller, because each different size of the split is going to be like a different shita and a little bit more of a shayla. Is it actually kosher or not? Just to give an example, our next trick over here: when one goes dalad meaning shopping or for a lot of other mitzvahs, one should always have a tape measure with him. Ideally, if you can, you can buy these in Judaica stores in and around Yerushalayim. You should have a tape measure that measures things in. It's bos and tfachim and amos. So you have a way to measure all the appropriate halachas where they're supposed to be done. And even better than that is to have a tape measure that the top has the measurements according to the Chazon Ish, and the bottom part is all the same things according to the sheet of Rav Chaim Noah, who was the other great gadol from two generations now back, who translated the shiurim into modern day terms. So that way you have a clear example of what these things are. So, for example, let's speak about a tefach. Right over here by this dot is a tefach according to the Chazon Ish. That means the way the Taz holds, if the tiyomis is split from here to wherever that finger is, that's what makes it possible. But up until that stage, it's totally fine according to the Taz. That's a fairly big split. Reb Chaim Noah felt the tefach got you up to this finger over here, but slightly smaller. Generally speaking, the shiurim of Reb Chaim Noah were smaller than the Chazon Ish, okay? And both of the shiurim are used lahalacha. We always try to make sure that we're being machmir for whatever the more chamur opinion is. Meaning to say, if you want to play it safe and know that you're in the halacha clear, so you make sure that what you use the shear that gets you where you have to get to. Although, interestingly enough, I always enjoy pointing this out. Interestingly enough, with all the digs that were done on the in and around the Har HaBayis and in areas in Yerushalayim, where we know from Chazal what measurements of different things were. Interestingly enough, all the digs that were done on Har HaBayis have the measurements of the Amos exactly like the Chazon Ish. Exactly like the Shita of the Chazon Ish. Again, so the Sanhedrin will be Machria someday, who's correct, the Chazon Ish or Reb Chaim Noah. But at least what the diggy people have done have definitely shown that the Chazon Ish is what was used, done on that. We know the measurements of where things were on the Har HaBayis, and that's the Fi, the Shitos, and measurements of the Chazon Ish. But that doesn't mean that we pass it like that 100%, but that should be kept in mind. Now, Let's get back to some of the questions, and then we move on. Ezra.
We said that it's so equipment that the puzzle isn't already puzzled from the hemnic.
Common question. This is why people get make a mistake. When the leaves can be split, but they still are totally closed up on the top, like this.
Right?
So that's nechlukatiyomes, but it's not a hemnik. Right? It doesn't matter. That's called split. So that split means that they're glued together. There's a natural glue inside. They're like this little sticky. Your hands get sticky. Right. That's the Yavur point. Yeah, right. What was that? Exactly. No. This one, if the leaves are separated, as long as there's two leaves, it looks fine. But if they're separated, we're more careful about that tiyomis leaf than the others. But you got the idea. In other words, they can be separate, but they're just like, you know, laying on top of each other. Like my hands right now. Like they're laying on top. They're flush with each other. They're not glued together. Right? So the hemnik is when you have the when they actually grow apart from each other. And nechlika is when they're just not glued together, but they're laying one on top of each other nice and neatly.
This is pretty evident. If you see it, you can't buy it.
What do you mean?
You say unless it's completely closed, it's pretty evident to buy it.
No, you know that's maybe an extreme way of saying it. It's for sure a hider. It's for sure more lechatchila that the wolves should be totally closed up until the top. Right? Would one say that if there was a little split, you're only doing a b'deivad mitzvah? It's not really true, because the bottom line is that there are many opinions that hold that's totally fine. Is that like the best 100%? No. Is that like, you're only yotze b'deivad? No, also not. Just when you're going and being proactive, I'm looking for a lulav right now, you want to try to get one that's as better as you can. If that's not as available, so then you have to start knowing all the other things to factor in to find something that's still, you know, that's still totally, you know, that's still totally l'chatchila. Yeah.
How do we factor in the brown stuff that separates between the two?
Okay, let me just make sure we didn't figure that out later. I don't think we did, but let's. Okay, now there is something that Abby called that brown stuff that separates in between the two. Now, that was a very scientific explanation. So that is known. So we got where the picture is here. That is something that's known as kara. Let's talk about that just for a moment. It's a fair and good question. Let me just find you a picture so we can make sure what we're talking about here. I got a good picture now. Okay, you're probably all familiar with, and for some reason this picture is not like as clear. Lulavim oftentimes have on the top of the lulav like this brown stuff on top. Okay, like a clump. It almost looks like a clump of solid dirt, right? And the top of the lulav covered with not dirt. It's like lulav stuff. It grows on the lulav. It's like some kind of like a thing, like there. So now here we have it's very interesting. The questions about this kara on top of the lulav are not discussed in the Gemara. They're not discussed in the Rishonim. They're not discussed in Shulchan Aruch at all. They're not discussed really in the older poskim. Like it was just like an issue that was like a non entity. The bottom line is like this. There became two schools of thought about that. Let's back up. The problem is that, or the question is when you have a lulav that's covered by kara on the top, you can't really properly inspect the tiyomis. You can't really properly inspect the middle leaf because you can't see it, right? It's covered by a shell on top. Now we also know that halacha tells us, you have always a right to be somich on a rove, right? And rove of the lulavim are not like, don't have things that are actually pusil going on the top. You can have different shaylas, you can have things that are maybe not, 100% perfect, but the rove of the lulavim are certainly kasher, like that. So many were of the opinion that, listen, if you have the kar on top of the lulav, chances are that you're really fine and gevaldik, okay? Extra added advantage that because it has like a shell on top of it, so it's not going to break or get damaged or whatever it is, because it really is pretty protected and covered, comes in natural packaging, and you're good to go. Others were of the opinion that, bottom line is, unless you can actually see and inspect, like, how do you know? Why be something on a rove if you can actually with your own eyes like see that you're getting something that you're 100% that you're 100% all right? These are sugyas in the first parak of Masechta Pesachim. When do we rely on a chazak or a rove if I can be mevarer the questions, and therefore it's fairly very very common for people to try to avoid using a lula with a kara on top. Now, that's in an extreme version where the kara covers the entire top of the lulav. Sometimes it can happen that when you look at the shpit, when you look at the tiyomis of the lulav, that you'll find that there's like little pieces of kara that are there. You see it over here. You can have, if you look carefully, you might have you have like a little bit of, you don't, yeah, you, it's not possible to see from where you're sitting. You were too far away. But sometimes you find the top of the leaf, there'll be like, it looks like there's a little brown that's there. Again, the lulav is not covered with anything. It just looks like there's like a little something there on that top part. So now, what more often than not, almost always, that little brown is not in between the two leaves. If it was in between the two leaves, then the leaves would not be closed. That would be a mashihu, a little bit of a nechlakatiyomis, in which case we'd be like, not as lechatchil as we might want to be. Almost always, though, when that's the case, when there's that little brown on the top, it's a little brown that's on the outside, on top of the leaves, and not actually inside the leaves proper. If that's the case, then the lulav is still going to be totally kosher. That's not called nechlokatiyomis at all. And it takes like a little bit more of a careful trained eye with experience to be able to look and see if it's on top or in the middle between the two. Yeah.
Can one peel off the brown stuff on the back of the lulav?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The only thing is, you should, some things are like obvious that like you can just rip it off and nothing happens and like take it off. If it's not as obvious, and you're a little bit like aggressive the way you peel something off, you can like rip off like like an important part of your lulav that you don't want to do. And sometimes it gets even more sensitive if you have like this, like we were just describing, where you have like a little brown on the top, and if you're pretty sure that it's just on the top and not inside the leaf. You can have someone who wants to be like a little overzealous and who wet the top of his lulav, take a pin and try to scrape it out, and by doing that he really could mess up the lulav, whereas like in reality it really just was something sitting on the top. That's why it's better to just ask the question to somebody who like knows what they're looking at, and they'll tell you if it's fine or what do you call it, or not. Okay, that's in terms of the lulav being split on the top. Let's go a little bit weiter over here. The nektam rosho. Nektam rosho. Now, was that okay? A nektam nektam rosh means where the top of the lulav is cut off or broken off. Now, a list of some of the halachas over here, according to the opinion of the Ramah. Okay, the Ramah's shita is that if the top of the tiyomis is broken off, the lulav becomes pasul as a nektam rosho. Okay, now, according to the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch, that's not really true. The Mechaber holds that nektam is only going to be if rove of the leaves that are above the shedra are cut off. So for example, if the shedra ends, I'm just going to say for argument's sake right about over here, according to the Pesach in the Shulchan Aruch, that the, again, I don't know if Sfaradim actually do this or not, it would take the majority of all of these leaves to be broken in order to, for the lulav to become pasul. The Ramah has it only the tiyomis has to become a nekta, like that. So that's a, oh, what do you call it? It's a very, very, you know, big machlokas. According to the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch, we're much, much more makel about a nektam roshan than according to the Ramah. But according to the Ramah's standard Ashkenazi Pesach Halacha, if that top of the tiyomis gets split, I know split rather, gets broken in any way, so that is going to pasul the lulav. The Groz Shita was, and this is how we paskin, you know, Halacha Lamaisa, the Groz Shita was, is that when we say if the top gets broken off, that means even if it's broken off a little bit, it doesn't have to be that it was axed off like a wham, you know, and you cut off half of the leaf, even if one little bit is actually broken off on the top, that is going to pasul the lulav. Now, that actually comes up more often than you would think. You can have like lulav that have real shilas of nektam. Again, if you're experienced, you can look at it and see if something is a nektam or not. If you're not as experienced, though, you should look. And if you're not sure, like look at it, then for sure go and ask a, you know, for sure go and ask a question to make sure. But it's something that you do have to look and look for, and do not assume that the tops of all the lulavim are okay. It's very easy for a lulav to become a nektam because bottom line is they're being handled in boxes, they're being handled by people, there might be even crowds around, you know, tables of lulavim. So it's not a crazy thing for an innocent guy to, like, you know, walk by and bang the top of the thing and was being handled in their box. It got, you know, banged against the, sorry, watch out your head. It got banged against, you know, the wall of the box a little bit, you know, too sharp, and something got split off, you know, a tear on the top. So something that you do have to look out for, and if you're not sure, you definitely want to be asking a question. Now, what was that? Yeah, a kosher atiyomis. There's posts can talk, Biralach and others talk about what happens if you had a nectum like that on rove or the other leaves. Also, we probably would be machmir about that, but the one that we're focused on is the tiyomis. Yeah.
When Shofar says the other leaves, so does it mean when it starts to grow above the shedra or anything?
Any ones that are above the shedra. No, we assume that. Yeah, we assume that. Good question. Yeah, we do assume that. Now, one of the other things that you'll have, and it's not a bad idea to get, when you start, you know, getting a little bit more involved in lulav inspecting, is a loop, a little magnifying glass. And when you have a little loop, you're able to take the thing. If a lot of times, like we said, if the shot is just a nektam and a mashahu, now again, you just have to be careful. It's only going to be puzzle if you can see the nectum with the naked eye. If you can tell when you look at it, oh, you know what, that looks like the top leaf was broken off. But sometimes you see an issue with the naked eye, like you see there's something there, you're not sure about it. If you want to be more sure, that's where a magnifying glass comes in. In other words, if to the naked eye it looks 100% totally fine, complete, perfect on top, you're not mukhiv to go with a magnifying glass and, you know, take a look and try to see, oh, you know, is it a nektam or not? Even if it was a little broken, but if it's not visible to the naked eye, that's not called a mashu. That's even smaller than a mashu, and that wouldn't pass the lula. But if you do notice that something is there and you say, hey, what's the story with that? And you're looking, you know, like it's just a little hard for me to see right now. So that's where using a magnifying glass is going to come into play. So these things become very, very important to have for a lot of reasons that I'm going to talk about as we go on. They become very important, you know, to have when you're inspecting your dalet, when you're inspecting your dalet meat. Now, the truth be told, that they're not all that expensive. You can buy them in, like, you know, cheap hardware stores for a couple of shekel. They do not have to cost a lot of money. This one happens to cost a lot of money. It was, like, you know, bought for me by a jeweler, someone who, like, really needed a, you know, fairly good one. Again, these are for all different kinds of shilas and other things that require very sharp vision. But you can buy one, you know, that's inexpensive, and you don't just have some in your pocket that you can, first of all, you can look cool with, or you can actually get a little bit more, you know, training for yourself in how to tell what a nektam is or not. The general simple rule is that if the leaf was broken off, it's gonna, the top of the leaf is gonna be flat. if the leaf was not broken off, and it's not like I said, sometimes it looks like there's something funny about it, and it's not like a regular closed lulav on the top, so a lulav can grow with like a little flat head also. What will happen is on the top of the leaf, there'll be a little round indentation. So if you see the round indentation, then you know that it's not a nectum, and if not, it just looks flat, so then you know that it is a nectum. But again, you have to see a couple of those, a bunch of those to get a good feel what that looks like, but once you know how to look at it, it's very easy to see. Is it a nectum or not? Okay, let's roll on. There is another Mishnah Berurah who says a very interesting thing, and that is that sometimes you'll find a lulav that has two tiyomis in, okay, where there's actually two leaves that are growing out of the shedra, two middle leaves. Again, that's just a mitzvah that happens, and it happens not so uncommonly also, that you have two tiyomises. So the halakha tells us that depending on the particular area, sometimes all the chumros apply to both of the tiyomisin, and sometimes not. Okay, so that gets a little tricky. Bottom line is, over here, the Mishnah Berurah says, if one of the tiyomisin is nektam, and the other one is not, the lulav is still going to be kasher. So it's still going to be fine, and what do you call it? And like that. Now, Mishnah Berurah does bring a suffix, but again, this doesn't happen all that often. If you have a nectum, or if the tiyomis is broken, and there's no other lulavim available, would you still be allowed to make a bracha on a lulav that's only kasher according to the Shulchan Aruch? That's totally possible according to the Ramah. So that's a shayla. Again, it's not so negate to us, Baruch Hashem, anymore. Nowadays, these are very, very common shaylas in Europe, especially during the Holocaust years, but even before that, lulavim and esrogim were not readily available, growing in Eastern Europe, and it was not always so easy to have. There were many, many communities where there's only one set of dalet minim for an entire city, and people would line up, and then each one would make a bracha, and then pass it over to the next. So sometimes you had, in situations like that, the only lulav that was available was something that like wasn't really like so so great. So you had more complicated shaylas. Again, I'm throwing that out there just to be aware of some of the trials and travails that people had to go through. We cannot under appreciate the bounty that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us in the past number of years, and the fact that we all, one thing I can tell you, almost all of you will have a nicer lulav and esrog this year than many, many, many Gedolei Yisrael had during Holocaust years, even sometimes before that. The availability of things that are just good and is really much more common nowadays, and we have more money. People are able to actually buy things and access things. Something that we really do have to take. We have to be very, very thankful for that we have those. That we have those opportunities today that were not always available to people, at large. I remember hearing once from Shmuel Berenbaum. That was the Rashi of the Mira Rashi in Brooklyn, one of the great Miras from Shanghai. So he had once said, and it's like impossible to like appreciate. He said in Baranovich, when he was learning in Baranovich, there were three pairs of tefillin in the entire yeshiva. Three bachram had tefillin, and the other one just sheared. Like after davening, people put on tefillin before, they have whatever it was, and like that. So it's like, it's hard to imagine what you like, everyone was like the COVID shiur, and Rabbi Chanan Vassim did that, like, and people just didn't have tefillin like to wear. It was like a whole different, ballpark than what we're familiar with. We really should appreciate that a lot. Okay. And hopefully we won't go back to the other way, Be'ezer Hashem, and let's keep it the way things are now. Moving on, a lulav that is yavish, but yet this is actually not necessarily yavish. Okay, what is a yavish? There's two shitas how a yavish works. The way the Shulchan Aruch brings, if it goes from green to white, that becomes yavish. Okay, and this is an example of that. The Mechaber brings another day, Mishnah Berurah brings another day that says that says something different. That to be considered yavish, it has to be so dried out that if when you play with your fingers on the thing, it snaps, and just it's so brittle that it snaps, that's called yavish. According to that opinion, this is not a yavish. It's actually surprising. Now, keep in mind that because of that, when you were living in times where like these lulavim were not so readily available, people actually used to keep lulavim from year to year. Right? At the end of Sukkot, you put a little ring around the thing so it didn't lean over and become all gross and ugly like this one was. It would still look like a lulav. From year to year, they do not become that brittle that they break when they're in your hand. And there's a real day up. And Postman says that's still not called a yavesh, and therefore you pay people using lulavim that look much, 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 much worse off than the one that we are holding over here now. Now, the Mishnah Berurah brings though an important shita for us. The Mishnah Berurah brings a shita of the Ravid, and the Ravid says that if the middle leaf, the tiyomis, becomes white, that also will passel the lulav. That will also passel the lulav. Not that the whole lulav becomes. Went from green to white, but even just the tiyomes being white, that can also pass the lulav. And we recorded in the thing over here, the Shabur doesn't bring this, but there's a machlokas in the poskim. What happens if only a mashu of the top of the lulav is white? Does that pasul the lulav? The two sheets are the gra at in the Bira Gran Shulchan Aruch was Machmir, the Bikur Yaakov was Mekel about that. And that's not an uncommon question either. You can have where the lulav looks pretty good, but at the top of the lulav, like the upper part, it can actually become a color just like what we have right over here now. It can really just mamish be at the top of the lulav. Then, according to the gra, that lulav is going to be pasul, and then that shouldn't be used. So again, if you have a choice of getting a lulav where the top is actually either fully green, less than fully green, but you know, still greenish, you know, like that. So that is something that you want to be looking for. So when you're going to inspect your lulav, you do want to make sure that the top of the lulav is green, really as up to the top as you possibly can get. One other kula that we pointed out over here. Sometimes the top of the lulav can get what we call sunburned. It becomes saruf. Okay, if it's sunburned. Sunburn just means it was out in the sun, becomes like brownish because it was out in the sun. So that actually is still kosher. That's not called the yavesh, and that is still fine, still good to go. Yeah. Yeah, they both. One thing is for sure, if the tiyomis is dried out like that, that for sure is going to pass all the love also. Good morning. No, I mean to the color of the leaf. If you painted it white, like that wouldn't pass the lulav either. You know, it has to be that the lulav dried out so that it becomes yavesh. Both the lulav is okay. No, the mechaber holds that just this white. It's more the chorma. There's another kula that's brought. That's brought in both in the Shulchan Aruch Mishnah Berurah that yavesh only means that it's so brittle that it would break again. But according to the Mechaber, this kind of lulav is pretty possible also. It's pretty not so great. This is already called basically white. The Tosfos brings like that in Sukkah. It's a day in Rishon. It's a popular day in Rishon. Bag is fine. We care. What you can see is what you get. Get this, not this. I mean, get this, not this. The old lulavim are not green in the bag. I cannot do lulavim. That's not green in the bag. That's all fine. The part with the shedder that faces you. That's the real branch. That's just the way the tree grows on the thing. They don't look the same at all. Two tiyomis and it's clear that there's two full leaves that are growing out of the back. Like if we see one, I'll show it to you. I mean, it's very visible. It's not a tricky thing to see. Sometimes it's not so clear if it's two tiyomis and or one tiyomis. Like you know, you can have like a thing that looks a bit borderline, like that. But it's clear that it's not a split. They're very much two separate things growing out of the thing. Okay. Let's speak a little bit about the shiur of a lulav. This also becomes negayah to us in a bunch of different areas. The way it's brought in Shulchan Aruch over here, I think we're doing this sort of okay with the time. We're getting it. Okay. that a shear of a lulav is supposed to be four tefachim high. Now, we're going to explain what exactly that means and how that plays itself out. We gave you a nice little convenient chart over here, okay? That you can carry this chart in your back pocket so you can know how big a lulav is meant to be. You have two different charts. You have, actually, there's like sort of like four different things you're looking at over here. The first little thing is a basic shear of a tefach, according to the Chazon Ish and Reb Chaim Noe. In their shiurim of what's considered a tefach or not, I gave you both in inches and centimeters. Okay, most of the time when you see things written in Sfarim, they're in centimeters because the metric system is more common throughout the world. But you should know what the inch translation is also. And if you notice, there is a fairly large difference between a tefach according to the Chazon Ish and a tefach according to Reb Chaim Noe. Again, Reb Chaim Noe is one of the Gedolim of Yerushalayim from two generations back, and Reb Chaim and the Chazon Ish was of course we know who he was. Now, although this should be simple, we just did the math for you also. We just took the shear of a tefach and times it by four so that you know how big a lulav is actually meant to be. So it will come out according to the Chazon Ish, it has to be 39 centimeters, and according to Reb Chaim Noe, only 32 centimeters. Now, so for example, the shear of Dalet Tfachim, according to the Chazon Ish, is like this. This alone is Dalet Tfachim. Now, the shedra of the lulav has to be Dalet Tfachim, not the entire lulav. Again, this is pretty easy when it comes to buying a lulav to have a lulav that is not this small, okay? But you can definitely have like a little pitsky size lulavim. So just be aware. You don't have to like measure it. If you just see it and it looks like anything bigger than this, like then you're really safe. Now, what there's two things to be aware about when it comes to the shear of a lulav, which is why I want to discuss this over here. Ner nogeya more to net. Not purchasing the lulav, but had a, we'll call, assemble the lulav afterwards and put the hadassim and the aravos along with the lulav. Lichatchila, you want to make sure that the lulav sticks out a tefach past the hadassim and the aravos. Okay, what does that mean? Okay, what does that mean? So what that means is that even if the lulav is a shear, now the shear for hadassim and aravos is only going to be three tefachim. Okay? In theory, every lulav has to be, the shedra of every lulav is going to be one tefach bigger than the hadassim and the aravos, and a minimal shear. But a lot of times, more often than that, your hadassim and the aravos themselves are not the minimum shear of three tefachim. They're a little bit bigger than that also. So the lechatchila is, when you make the lulav, when you make the lulav, you want to make sure that you're actually b'mitzias, physically, practically, having that the lulav is a, they're sticking out, the shedra of the lulav is sticking out a tefach above where the hadassim and the aravos are. I pointed out in the sheet that for this kind of a hider, it's certainly okay to use the smaller shear of a tefach of Chaim Noe. 8 centimeters is enough that the shedra should be sticking, past where the hadassim and the aravos are. There is another chumrah that's brought, but it's a real thing quoted by the poskim. We know that we put rings around the lulav also, right? They're little like lulav rings that are there. The lulav, the shedra of the lulav should be a tefach above the uppermost ring. I pointed out that the two menhagim, you put two or three rings on the lulav. However many you put on, though, there should be a tefach of the shedra that's protruding past past whatever that top ring is. Now that means a very, very simple thing. You're going to be the ones who are putting the rings on the lulav. So all you got to do is make sure to put the ring on in the first place, right? A tefach beneath where the shedra is. Yeah.
That part has to be a tefach higher than
the hadassim,
which has to be minimal,
which is
fucking high.
Yeah.
The ring has to be in respect to that.
Tefach, tefach,
yeah.
It's easy to do.
In line with
hadassim. What was that?
Is it in line with the top of the hadassim
ring? Yeah, in theory. It doesn't always have to work out like that, but in theory. Yeah.
Does that mean that the additional tefach has to be above the actual... Are those in the hadassim, or where it's attached?
Above the hadassim, right? It's on top of.
Okay. another. So what if it goes up to like here though?
So then put them lower down.
Oh yeah, and then have, okay.
Yeah. It gets a little annoying. I sometimes have like where my hadassim rubbers, like just the bottoms of them are sticking out underneath the lulav, just in order to make sure that all the measurements of it, like, looks a little funny, but they're just like, you know, you got like turbo jets in the back sticking out for that. What was that? Yeah, so you just, as long as you're holding everything in your hand at the same time, it doesn't matter where they are, so it can stick out in the bottom. You can still have a thing up over here. Yeah.
If they're sticking out too far, can you stiff them or no?
Well, first of all, if you're ever going to stim anything, you stim from the bottom and not from the top. But you can, that is okay to do, but you should, you got to make sure that you're not compromising any of the kashrus of what you're snipping off. In other words, when you want to have this like shear of the, you know, the three tefachim like that, like if you snip off the bottom, you might have just cut off like part of what you, you know, part of what you wanted to have there, like that. So, you know, don't always be so quick to cut things off. Okay, moving right along. We are done right now with our official discussion of lulavim. How about that? And we're going to move on to hadassim. Move on to hadassim. Lulav questions before we move on. Very good. Yeah. Well, as many as you need. I mean, unless your lulav is like really, really like way too like emaciated to begin with, like you're really safe to do. You can just also buy them for like 10 agirot from like kids that are gonna sell them to you like incessantly at the thing. They're cute little kids, like the white Pamam Yarmulkes, and they're called tabo. They're gonna like shove them in your face all the time. Like, you can't like escape without like giving money to some kid with the Pamam in his head. Yeah.
Except for the middle. All of the leaves can be split off.
Ooh, if the rove or the leaves are split, that becomes even according to Machaber, that's not good.
Let's see, the
rove is
on the bottom.
On the tops and that's fine. We don't really care so much about those.
Not the bottom.
Which is why you can rip them off, right?
Huh? Yeah, I mean, you can rip them off because as long as you have like, you know, some basic leaves on the side, you're good. You know, so you could rip off if you want. Yeah, you know, a lot of people like having like a thicker, you know, healthier looking lulav. You don't want to like rip it off too much; it looks a little like wimpy then. But in theory, you can. In theory, you can. Final questions: 1, 2, 3. I mean, it's not the last opportunity. You still can ask afterwards, but okay. So let's roll. Now, the. You know what, but actually two things. Just other terms that you want to know about lulav, and we might as well make this as complete as we possibly can. These are not really halakhic issues, these are a couple of practical things. They're growing in the land of Israel. There are over 24 species of palm trees that grow here. Okay? And not all of them necessarily kosher to be used as a lulav. Things that grow from a palm tree, first of all, there's a shayla. If it sure should be that the species of palm tree grows, because of palm dates, you know, should be growing on the tree. You don't have to have that the particular tree has dates growing on it, but that the species of tree is a date growing tree. In order for it to be kosher as a lulav, some of them don't all have things like that, and some of them grow in funny kind of figurations that are less than clear. If those are kosher to be used as a, what do you call it, as a lulav. Yesterday we were driving out of Kiryat Arba. If you remember, I pointed out, like, take a look at those like trees that some guys cutting off a thing. Those are examples of lulavim that grow from the middle of a tree that, you know, that would not have been kosher for lulav. The tzura of the way they grow, the poskim said, was not you know, kosher for a lulav. It's an uncommon thing because it really got like squelched in early on. They had started for a period of time to import both to America and to Eretz Israel a lulav that grew on the Canary Islands, called a Canary lulav. Shlomo Zalman held that was kosher, others held that was not. So that's pretty much out of the question. You don't have to really worry about encountering one of those. There are two terms you should be aware of, though, that are, like, you know, when you're shopping for a lulav, you should look for. There was a guy named Kubin who lived in Tzfat, a while ago, a number of years ago, he had, you know, took upon himself to try to, like, go the, you know, length and breadth of the country and find, like, palm trees that really, really grew, like, you know, nice lulavim on them, and, you know, both to have a good, you know, kashrut lulav for himself, but also to, you know, to market and whatever it was. So he discovered one of the many kinds of lulav trees that grow here was something else that they called the species was called Deri, Dalet Resh Yud. You'll hear a lot of people like are advertising or screaming at their stands that they're selling Deri lulavim. Truth be told, they often are, you know, a little bit like thicker, nicer, greener, more closed than some of the other, you know, things that are available. So if, you know, if you look for one of those, you know, you might be getting yourself putting yourself in a position where you can be getting something that you know that might be more possibly, you know, easily, you know, totally kosher and lechatchila than other kinds. There are lulavim that are grown in a place in Egypt called El Arish. So those lulavim also are imported into Eretz Yisrael, can be pretty good. The dairy ones are generally speaking nicer, but those are like two very common sources of lulavim. What? Arish with an aleph, with an ayin rather. Ayin reish yishet. Okay. Moving right along. But again, if you could choose to get one of the dairy lulav in there, they're really safer. But just pretend this guy Coben, he sells not they might have a stand in a shuk, but they have a place somewhere else. His lulav are pretty good. Right? They actually are very nice. They're a little bit more expensive. Their pricing wise, you should assume that if you want to get a lulav that's pretty okay, that's you're going to be in like 150, a little bit less than that, you know, range. So just in terms of like budgeting yourself as you're approaching Yom Tov, 100 can be pretty good.
For
everything. Or shekels, a lulav. What was that? To get one that's like pretty okay, I don't actually pretty good. That's you know, nice mahoder and whatever. It's 150. You know, you probably won't be spending more than that on a lulav if you want to, you know, go for something that's nice. Or again, we can buy lulav that are way more than double that. But not that you're going to see at the, you know, in the shuk that day. And again, you can get things that really are fine for that price. And again, 100, you know, like that, 90, 80, something like that is, you know, but less than that, you're going to be, you know, it's not going to be so great. Okay, let's move into Hadassim. Where am I? I keep turning the pages and going the wrong direction. Hold on. Hadassim, here we are. Okay. Hadassim. Now, Hadassim are, what do they call them in English? Myrtle things, right? They grow on bushes. And hadassim actually are pretty, are not so easy either. So we're going to go through all the dinim of the hadassim. And then I think after that we're going to take a break for a couple of minutes. And then we're going to come back and finish off with the esrogim and the aravos. Let's get to the hadassim page here. And then we go. Okay. Now, what we need to know about hadassim is a couple of things. Yeah, we're good to go. The first thing and the most important thing about the hadassim, and that's the most difficult and what's going to take you a while to actually be able to ascertain, is something that's called the hadass has to be. They have to be mishulashin. Mishulashin means they have to be three leaves. We're going to describe what that means as we go along. But three leaves that grow in a line around the branch. It's very, very common that hadassim only have two leaves on them. If you walk around, there's all over, even just here in Telson, growing on the street corners in front of people's houses, hadassim bushes. Most of them, when they're, you know, just left and unattended to at all, aren't mishulashim. You have to play with it a little bit, you know, to make sure they grow properly. There's a lot of unmishulash at the hadas branches, so don't just, you know, cut hadassim off of a bush without actually looking at it, which is, you know, it's not a good idea anyway. But we're going to explain now what exactly mishulashim means. We're going to talk about that all. A great question. Okay. Now, let's roll. There is a machlokas. I'm just going to walk through the bullets over here now. There is a machlokas amongst the poskim how to define what mishulash is going to be. And this machlokas is going to have a tremendous bearing on the price of the hadassim. You know, it's how like kosher according to everybody it actually is going to be. The sheet of the Chazon Ish was, and I'll show you pictures as we're going along, the sheet of the Chazon Ish was is that the bases of the stems have to overlap in order for it to be a mishulash. I'm not going to show you the pictures until we're done reading. The sheet of Shlomo Zalman. Fine. Is it from in there? They let you take them?
Yeah. Just
okay.
As long as you don't open it.
The shita of Shlomo Zalman Orbach was that the stems of the hadassim, the stems of the leaves have to overlap in order for it to be called mishulash. Okay, both of them agree that it would not be sufficient if just the leaves alone were all in a straight line. Why do I say both of them? Because truth be told, it might be mashma in places in Rishonim that would have been kasher, but that's not something that really any of the contemporary poskim have you know paskin halacha l'maisa. So let's talk about what that means, and then we'll give you a live demonstration on a hadas in a closed package that we can't really take out, but we can get a look at. And that is like this. We're going to be careful with them. Here you have three drawings. Yeah, the drawings make it a little bit easier to see. In drawing number one, actually, let me explain what I'm looking at. Here, let me just move back. Maybe we can see a little bit. We'll keep doing that, yeah. It's good that you joined us. Okay, this is a leaf. The green things are the leaves, okay? The brown things are the stems. And if you notice, there's like a black circle or dot over here in the thing. We're going to do this everywhere except in that direction. There's a little black little thing over there. That's the base of the stem, okay? See what I'm talking about? You can actually sort of envision this because it's not so hard to understand. There's a leaf, there's a stem, and there's a base. The base of the stem is where the stem is mechubber to the branch. You know what a branch is, right? Like what Chavos Chaim people do? Yeah? Okay. Now, so let's talk like this. According to the Chazon Ish, you have to have that the bases over here have to all be coming out of the same line. There's an expression to use, the chut hamakiv, the circumference. When you make an imaginary line around the branch of the hadas, okay, that those bases should all be coming from the same place. Okay, even if they're not exactly in the same place, but as long as the bases overlap with each other, that would have been called thing. What?
For each row,
up the entire shear that you have to have of the hadas, right? Everyone. Now, Rav Shlomo Zalman held, well, we're going to get that later. We're going to put it all together afterwards. Rav Shlomo Zalman held, even if the bases are not exactly in the same line with each other, but as long as the stems, right, the stem of the leaf is all in one line, that's also going to be called a mishulash. That would be fine. Now, one has to actually look at the hadassim in order to like see if that is actually taking place. It's not obvious. Sometimes you can look at a hadas and you see, oh, there's three leaves and it looks, you know, very pretty, nice green leaves or whatever it is. And upon more careful examination, you notice that although the leaves do look like they're going around in a row around the branch of the tree, but like the bottom line is those stems. And sometimes, you know, the stems don't line up. Sometimes the bases for sure don't line up. We're going to ask maybe perhaps over here to actually do this like for real. It might be better if we could gather around a little bit and then we can give some explanations. Because it's going to be hard to see. Okay. Now, let's pick it a little bit. Okay, just don't breathe too much on it because they're already getting fucked up. So just watch out, just stay away. Hold on, give us some air. Yeah, make sure you hold like this, yeah. Don't let yourself too much on that in the baggage. Yeah.
Not
the way. And use mouthwash, what?
Whose is that?
From in there. Okay, let me just take what we can just see easily.
Give them back to the back.
Okay. Let's take a look. Oh, at this one here. Okay? This is the base, where it goes into the thing. You would make a line. This base line up with that base there. Right? In this particular case it does. Right? Then you would move it a little bit, right? And again, wherever you have the plastic thing, see, it's a little bit harder to see. But then you would see, does that base line up with the next base? Let me show you an example where that might not be like that. Let's see if we can. It could be a very nice of that, so we have to see if we can catch him over here.
One of those
older
bases are lined up.
Yeah, here the bases are lined up also. Okay, the stem is this green part.
Just that little.
So even if this little, this thing and this thing are not in a line.
But isn't that the base? Where is the
bottom? Where it's attached to the thing. So that's where these are. You know, again, it's hard to show without. The stem is the green part in the base there where it's stuck into the.
So
where's Michelle?
Like that 1 centimeter thing, as long as it's.
Yeah, these have to come in a line with each other, right?
Every single one has to be like that?
The entire shear. So we can talk about the shear room in a second. Yeah.
But the shear room in a second. Early.
There's now, the
when are we going?
Then there's the little step. Oh, I don't know.
As long as these look pretty okay. Let's see on this side, or should I get two on the door?
How are we getting there?
It's already being new.
Okay, here's a good example. Here's an example. This one right over here, where my pen is, where the bases are not lined up with each other.
That's where it is in the.
So this one here, this row, the bases are not lined up, the stems are lined up. Right? That's how they show. This one is called the shiller. But the
Shlomo Zalman,
what?
Which one? This one? The little green thing is on.
This one
is
here.
So they don't have to be lined up at the
base. Is not exactly the same.
The base could be off.
Because here, that base is not the same.
The stem is in the same spot.
The stem is
over here.
Is not the same spot.
I don't think that's on the shoulder.
So according to people going like Shlomo Zalman, that whole thing wouldn't be about which
muscle? No, because if it's three plus, I'm not trying. There has to be a sheet of paper. We have to sheet of paper. In a second. Okay, thank you.
Now,
we didn't get there yet. Hold on. Now, we have an example of what a mishulash actually means. You know, if I forgot, whoops, if we were all around standing here anyway.
Right.
Yeah. I might as well just like look over here.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm trying to dust it up how long this should be.
Yes, it does, yeah. So just as an example, here's an example where the stems are, where the bases are all, you know, in a line. The same thing over here, right, like that. So that just like that, these are like, you know, in these bigger pictures, you can see a little bit better.
Do they have one with the stems in line and not the bases?
Yeah, probably not, if I had to guess. Like they were trying to show you the nice ones, but
there you go.
This is what it would look like, right?
And that would be fine according to your shoulder, so.
No, this over here would not be, because even the stems are not, right, okay. are not in the shoulder.
But this is life.
That one is okay, right?
No, this one is
shoulder.
Why?
Because
this is
shoulder.
Oh,
so just a little bit of the stems have to be.
Yeah, it's a little bit crossing over each other, yeah. Okay. Now, the...
Oh, so...
No, just be the shoulder.
We are continuing. Take your seats. Okay. Now, next point about the Hadassah. Now that we got the Mishulashim idea down pat-ish a little bit, we write like this. Ideally, the entire shear of the Hadassah, all three Tefachim, should be Mishulash. Okay? In other words, you want to make sure you have three Tefachim of Hadassah where you have that Shilush going on. Bottom line is, if the rove of the shear of the three tefachim is meshulash, then the hadas is still kasher also. Okay, if it's rove meshulash, then it's considered kasher. There is a shaila in the poskim. How do you define and calculate what exactly rove of the shear is? Now, obviously, rove of three is going to be a little bit more than 1.5. Right? That's when you're talking in terms of tefachim, though. Now you have a machlokas. So if you look at rove of the shear or rove of the branch, meaning to say, as I gave an example, if the branch is longer than three tefachim, do you have to have, which is very common, do you have to have the rove of the hadas that you're looking at is going to be meshulosh, or just rove of the kashir, rove of the kashir shear? That's a machlokas, and again, since it is a machlokas, and 100% clear what to do, you definitely would like, in theory, to make sure the rove of the actual branch in front of you is considered meshulash. But important to note that the point made in the next bullet, and that is that the rove of the meshulash does not have to be continuous or contiguous. What that means is that that you can have one row that's beautiful, one row that ain't so great, two rows that are great, one row that's not so great, and you can keep going on like that. But if you have a rove of the sum total of what you're looking at is going to be meshulash, that is still going to be okay. And that's why it becomes important to actually inspect the hadas from the bottom up and try to see row by row what's going on. Sometimes you can have at the bottom of the hadas, and this is actually not so uncommon, that the bottom of the hadas is not so great in terms of the meshulash. But as you're going up, there comes a point, and a lot of times it's like around over here, there comes a point where you see that it's like it's starting to go good, and then you notice from there all the way up to the top, everything is perfect, right? So that's going to be fine. We don't care so much about the part that's on the bottom, as long as, again, it can be even the entire shear of the gimel tefachim is going to be meshulash totally 100%. So that's going to be 100% mahudar and the chetchila and great. So you have to be looking at, again, at the entire picture, not just each part piece by piece. Again, as we pointed out, the shear of the hadas is the three tefachim, and we gave you the measurements how to exactly figure out what three tefachim is in terms of making sure you're going to have a shear. Now, you can buy a hadasim in different ways. And one way of buying hadasim is that you'll see in the shuk that you'll have people just with buckets of hadasim sitting in water. You can pull them out, look at them and inspect, hadas by hadas. If you're going to be doing that, obviously you have the option of picking, each branch that you can go through a lot of them and look for, branches that you like. Okay, it's going to be a little bit more arduous, it's going to be a little bit harder to do, but you certainly can do that. A lot of times, hadasim are sold in packages, and those packages will have labels on them, okay? And they will say things like the following things. So let's use this as an example. Mehudarim Aleph Aleph. Aleph Aleph means like A+, right? Like you did pretty good. That'll make a comment, it's Meshulash Kulo Shiur Chazon Ish, right? That's going to tell you that if whoever the Rav was that checked these Hadassim before they were packaged, measured that the entire three Tvachim of the Chazon Ish, all 29 centimeters, right, was Meshulash and fine. Okay, so if it's Meshulash Kulo, right, so that means it's more Mahudar. If it's only Rov, the fee, right, the shear of the Chazon Ish, so then that's kasher, but it's not as great. Okay? Now again, we pointed out that there's a whole nother shear of how to calculate what tefachim are and what three tefachim, Reb Chaim Na'eh. If it's only rove of the shear of Reb Chaim Na'eh, right? So then you're playing with fire a little bit, because that's less than the shear of the rove according to the Chazon Ish. You're less likely that's okay, but you can't say that that's going to be puzzle. So you can have, even though we sell hadas and then mehudarim aleph aleph, right? You can buy, you can actually find in the shuk like that are just written with like a bit bays on them. Like these are not so good, right? And like that, but they're all different kind of price range for a very cheap price. What do you call it? You can get a das that might be kosher if you're willing to take a chance. Rabbi Elman, you were the ones who brought these back. How much is a pack like this cost?
It's not fair. We got through
the Kupa. What was
that? We got through the
Kupa. In Tisa, do you know how much they were?
It's
60 stems, okay. And that was with the Kuma Bryce or the before?
Well, ours was
34. Wow, okay. So it's pretty good. Last night, someone was showing me packages of Hadassim, and it's a friend, someone who I work with. And they packed of Hadassim that were 180 shekel, like that, 190 shekel for a package. So the price ranges, you know, definitely vary. You can buy ones that are much, much cheaper also. And be like that. We're going to try to do at the shuk is the following thing. And that's why please remember this. I'm saying this now, and I'm going to repeat this like then, but just make sure we're getting this as much as we can. We're going to try to help you, okay, and make your life easier. What that's going to mean is, probably before you guys get there, either myself or A. Greenwald is going to have made a little walk around like the area. The truth is that it's worked out the past couple of years. We always ended up dealing with the same guy. And we're going to find someone who has not a bad price on package Hadassim that have the entire shear, Chazanish Meshulash. And we're going to promise him that I'm going to get a lot of people to buy from you, but you're going to give me a good price. Okay? So if you do that, you're going to get a good price on good Hadassim. This is an area where I'm going to encourage you not to walk around and try to be smarter than everybody else. You could try to do that, but you definitely are going to be much safer and get a much, much better price to get pretty decent, good quality things if you stick with us. So like that, just like keep that in mind. Like that again, you want to look at them and whatever, but just stick with us with that particular thing. Yeah.
So you recommend going to people to buy kits
anymore? You can if you want to get experience. If you want to buy buy yourself, what was that?
You dry out faster too, not in the packaging.
And I'm not sure. I don't know. I never really totally found it, but you're going to be better off and you're going to save a lot more money and probably in the end either end up getting something better like this or certainly not anything worse. So I wouldn't really recommend doing that for right now. And if you want again perfect Hadassim, so those are going to cost you a little bit more, but it doesn't have to be so crazy. Doesn't have to be so crazy at all. Let's move on. The next two things are actually fairly simple. Then we're gonna take a little seventh inning stretch over here. There's a psul of Yavish by Hadassim. Now, this is not so common. Okay, there is a psul of Yavish. Okay, if the leaves become dried out, that's going to be no good. The Shulchan Aruch brings down that Yavish means if when you touch the leaves, they're brittle enough that they break. That might not be so great. Again, if they're white, like we described earlier, that's going to be another Yavish issue. It doesn't happen all that often. They don't usually get that dried out over the course of Sukkot either. But if for some reason you think you might have a question about the Hadas being Yavish, you definitely want to ask a Rav. So just be aware that could happen, and like that. Now let me give you a little practical piece of advice when it comes to your Hadassim, to try to make sure that they're not Yavish. If you do not leave them in the sun, okay? If you don't leave them in like the baking sun in the trunk of somebody's car, etc., they're probably not going to become Yavish. If you leave your Hadassim out in the sun or in somebody's car, okay, for an extended period of time, they might, really might, have a more serious problem of becoming Yavish. So, for example, okay, on the let's start off with the day that you're buying your Dalet Minim, right? So you're gonna go to the Dalet Minim shuk in the morning, you buy your package of Hadassim. And let's say you ever so conveniently tie that package of Hadassim to the back of your knapsack that you're wearing, and you're gonna walk around like all day doing all your different errands with your Hadassim glued to your back. But that's gonna mean that the sun is gonna be beating on this little package like all day long, and they're gonna get dried out. You noticed before how vulnerable they were. This one, people were breathing right here, like how there was a, like a, more of a condensation on the pen. I pointed that out to you, right? So imagine if it's just like sitting in the sun for a while. You can like totally seriously mess up your hadassim. Some people always ask me every year, hey Rebbe, can I put my hadassim in your, Rebbe, you go back to Telstone, can I put my hadassim in the back of your trunk and whatever. So I almost inevitably after that particular trip have many hours of different things that I do in Yerushalayim to get ready for Yom Tov. And so if you leave your hadassim in my trunk, they will dry out. So go to make that clear, and that can happen and it does happen, so do not do that. Put them like somewhere in your knapsack. You might want to just be able to, like, if you put them in your knapsack and they're covered, they're not going to dry it as quick, but really try to make sure to get them like in somewhere and out of the sun as quick as you possibly can. There's also a psul of nektam when it comes to a hadas, but it's a little harder to get than when it comes to a lulav. A nektam by a hadas is only when the stem is broken off. So if you somehow or another, like again, you're keeping your dalamin in your knapsack when you're traveling around, you go on the bus and let's say you take a bus to go daven vasikin at the kotel one morning kolamoid, and those buses can be very, very, very packed in, like you're really like shoved into like glass with your face like in that like uncomfortable position, slammed over there. So your hadassim could end up like being stuck under somebody's like neck and like that, and they could get broken off. So again, you got to be careful with your dalamin when you're traveling on sukkahs, and so you avoid having problems of a nektam. Those are the basics that you need to know right now for the hadassim. And again, hopefully you'll stare at a couple of pairs and you get a better feel for how to make a hadass that is a proper mishulash. I got a very interesting photo with this. We'll close. This has nothing to do with the halacha. So just I found this like fascinating. I got a call 2 years ago on erev sukkahs. I have a farmer that grows hadassim in Oshav Nov in the Golan that sends me chunks of hadassim every year, of his better hadassim, and we've been working together for years, and so one year I get a phone call. Actually, a couple hours before Yom Tov, right? Gordon, are you in Yerushalayim? Where are you now? I'm at home. Hey, can you get something to Yerushalayim really, really quickly? I have a matana. I want to give a prayer. Can you get someone over here like as quick as you can? Okay. So this is fascinating. So I sent my son online that ended up going for me. It was very, very, very quick. He said he had two hadassim out of all they grow lots and lots of things. Two hadassim out of his field that had a perfect, not just three leaves, but four leaves around that. It was like very, very rare. There's no ma'ilan halacha, this in the slightest bit. Mishulish is like that. It was interesting. Like four leaves around the hadass, all of them in the perfect chazanish, shear, like up until the top. So one went to the son of a rebbe, and the other one he gave to me as a present. And so it was very, very, it was very pretty. So I auctioned off one of my other hadassim to one of my kids, and made a little money, why not? So that was really good. Some of these can get really interesting things. If you look around, these things like do pop up, and that was like a nice little pretty hadass. So we have pictures of it. But anyway, take a break. We're going to be starting at 10 to 12, Be'ez Hashem, with Esrog. And if someone could bring this back, Avichai, where'd you get this from? What was that?
Two or three were really, really good.
All three are always good.
Three are like really important.
That was only one.
You didn't want that soon?
No, one of
them. You only got one.
He gave you one and gave the other son whatever. Yeah.
Didn't I bring it last year?
What was that?
Did you bring it like last year or something?
I might have brought it. I remember.
What does this shear start from? Does it start from the bottom of the stem even though there are no things there?
No, the first leaves. You only can't pick the leaves.
If Ruby gets a whole bunch of them, does Ruby sell them at all? Ruby gets like stacks of them.
What was that?
Ruby gets like a whole bunch of them. Just a game?
I take the ones that I want, me and a friend, and then I don't know.
Maybe it's one of these.
Come on in. I just want to give a screen to the hole and in those directions that we're starting now. Thank you. Okay, so one final comment I'd forgotten to make about to answer someone's question about one of the Hadassim. So we'll just start off with that, and then we're going to jump into the Rabbi. Someone had asked before whether or not there was any kind of a minimum or maximum shiur to the individual leaves of the Hadassim. Okay, so we'll explain hopefully fairly simply, and that is that there is a tshuva in the Maharsham. Maharsham was one of the gedolim of pre-World War II Europe, the Brezhena Rav it was called. If anyone heard of the Maggid of Yerushalayim, Shalom Shvadron, I just got a whole like series like the Maggid speaks, Maggid this thing, like he was a famous Yerushalayim Maggid, so he was the grandson of the Maharsham. So Maharsham is a tshuva where he claims that if the leaves of the Hadas are bigger than a thumbnail, it's based on a sheet of the Bahag, that one should preferably not have a Hadas with leaves that are that big. Again, many people are not makbid like that, but in general, if generally speaking, the leaves are not that big anyway. But sometimes you'll see like a hadas that has like very big leaves, and you might think that looks all that's like pretty. Wow, look at those beautiful leaves. So the truth is that there are those who hold that really would not be good, and you're trying to make them less than a thumbnail size. Yeah. What was that? The size, like they look like thumbnails anyway. Those leaves, so like the whole thing. Yeah. That's all. Yeah. Okay. So now let's move into our rabbis. So we're going to do our rabbis next because they're the most easy, and it'll take very little time. Now, also be aware that rabbis are the species that will wilt and dry up and die the quickest. Our rabbis are not sold in the Dalin Minim Shuk. In the days leading up till Sukkot, so those you're gonna have to get by yourself afterwards. It's very easy to get, like just basically almost any of the packaged rabbis are fine. We'll give you some of the things you want to look at, but it's easy to find rabbis that are totally mahudir and kosher and great lechatchila, and you'll find them in whatever neighborhoods you're gonna be at. The day before Sukkot, the day of Erev Sukkot, they'll be out in abundance and in street corners and in shuls, and kids will sell in the street, and it's easy. That costs like 5-10 shekel, and they just buy maybe a little more, but they'll not more than 20 shekel for sure, and they're pretty easy to get. Okay, now so first and foremost, the arabos that we use. Shulchan Aruch brings something that is not all that common. There's one thing I'm pointing at that is a little bit more common. There is a psul that if the arava has extremely big ridges around the outside, so then that would not be good. Okay. Again, it's hard to see the leaf of any arava. It's going to roughly look like what you have over here. They're a little bit jagged around the sides of the leaves. So that's the way the leaves are supposed to be. They're not, usually not so incredibly smooth at all. But if the ridges are too big and too jagged, so that according to some is going to be a problematic. Again, it's not so common. There's a chai adam I brought on the sheet over here who has a chumrah that says something interesting, and he says that if the ridge, I mean, I just described it, if the ridges don't all face in the same direction, that's also possible. Meaning to say, the test, when you rub your finger around the edge of the arava, that the ridges are not going in one direction. And if you feel that wherever you go, you have like bumps, again, if they're all leaning in the same direction, you go like this, right? Then you're not really going to be going up and down. You're just going to be like riding the top of the ridges. I tried to do this like letters. If they look like the V's as opposed to the wings, so that's what it called. That's a great. If you can be machmir like the chay adam, that is, you know, that is a smart thing to do. Most of the aravos that are bought in the packages are like that, and don't have that and don't have that problem. The reason why I'm telling you that is because aravos are like grow all over the place in this country. It's not so hard to find wild aravos growing, you know, outside. There's a young aravo tree growing in the back of the yeshiva, actually, even, and so sometimes when you pick your own, if like you're like in a hiking somewhere, whatever it is, and you notice like some aravo tree that's in, and you rip some off. You can find like trees that have that. So just before you take an aravo, you should make sure to touch the leaves and make sure that they're not. They're not like that. The other thing that you need to know about an aravo is that there's a hider that the aravo should have what's called a lavlov. I'm going to get you a picture of a lavlov. I described it as a leaf that grows out of the stem of the aravo, and most of them come with that, but they don't all. What is a lavlov? If you look in this picture, you see there's a black arrow. Okay, that black arrow is pointing. That's what arrows do. They point. This little stem that sticks out on the top, that's called a lavlov. This little stem under the arrow, meaning this pen is pointing to an arrow, which is pointing to a level. Got that? As opposed to that not being there.
Every single thing has a level.
They don't all, but most of them do. I would just point at you, want to make sure that they're there.
This.
On the top of the thing, there's just like some like branch that grows out of it. So that thing is supposed to be there. It is a hider, a definite hider, for the aravo to have red branches to it. So when you're looking, let's say for example, like a picture like this, like the branch is of like a reddish color. Sometimes the branches are green. So if you're looking at different packages, like look for the ones that look redder, and that is better. Redder is better. Okay, remember that. Rhymes. Now, let's talk about Esrogim for a little while. That's going to take us till the end of the morning. The Esrogim are definitely, for most people, the more expensive of the things that are in the Dalimunim. Again, they don't have to be. The Lulavim can be more expensive than Esrogim, but they generally speaking, the Esrogim are more on the more expensive side. And again, just reminding you, even this is not an economics class here, but let's keep in mind, when you have like a budget of how much you think you're going to be wanting to spend on your dalad minim, so you have to like remember there are four things that you're going to have to be buying, right? So like you might, you know, sometimes have to prorate, like you might have to, you know, give in a little bit on this in order to make sure that, you know, that you're getting something else. So, you know, if you, I don't want to say compromise at all, but if you look for something that is l'chatchila, but not like the wow, you know, nicest thing you could ever find, but that enables you to, just using this as an example, to buy an esrog that's the same l'chatchila as your lulav was, right? So that's a, you know, intelligent thing to do. You don't want to like go all out on an esrog and not have enough money to buy like a decent lulav. So that would also be a mistake, you know, to do. Each one of them is important. All four of these, you know, parts are ma'akev of each other, and they all, you know, go into doing the mitzvah of you know, shaking a lulav and esrog properly. So, you know, they all have to be done. They all have to be done carefully. So you have to, like, again, keep in mind your bigger picture. Now, let's speak about esrogim, section 4. So we began with a comment. The esrog has many complicated halachos, and any final decision should be left to a competent posik. But we will address some of the basic issues to be on the lookout for. That being said, what we're trying to express over there is, don't necessarily like make the calls and the decisions on your own, but like you do need to be somewhat of an informed consumer to make sure you're not getting taken advantage of, and you know that things are what do you call it? Okay. Do not assume. Okay, and this like should be obvious, but it's not. But it's like, I'm going to spell this out for you. Do not assume that just because there's a guy behind the stand selling a lulav, hadassim, or esrogim, that he has like any idea what he's talking about in terms of whether or not things are kasher, or pasul, or lechatchila, b'di'evad, muhudr, or not muhudr. There's no correlation between people standing behind tables and knowledge and bekiyas in halachas of dal and minim. None in the slightest bit. Okay, so you should not assume that guy who's selling you the thing knows anything more than you do. That fair? Okay? So the more you know, the better off you're going to be in terms of not getting taken advantage from. Okay. Now, but at the same time, like, you know, some of these things actually, especially in the area of Esrogim, you know, do take a bit more shemesh to, you know, to get down pat. General concerns, okay, and these are very important, and this is going to be a little bit more nogeya to you this year than in other times. It should be totally relevant every single year, but sometimes the way people buy Dalet Minim, they ignore this part. But so, like, just be aware. An esrog must be an esrog. Okay? That means it has to be a real through and through 100% esrog and not a grafted esrog. The word grafted in Hebrew is called a murkav. Okay? There was a shaila that came up about 100 years ago in the poskim, not earlier than that, where when people started to realize that there were farmers who were grafting esrogim with other kinds of fruits to make them stronger, nicer, you know, other kinds of things. And poskim sat down to discuss, like, is that okay? Like, it sort of is an esrog, but what's the story? A scum of all the poskim, paskim, and mishnah berurah, no one argues on this. So the esrog cannot be anything other than a pure esrog and not a grafted one. I pointed out a marimakam on the page. Again, I didn't print it for you here, where the mishnah berurah gives you the simanim of how to identify, like, a real through and through esrog versus one that is grafted. Okay, you cannot tell from the outside alone. When you look at it, like, and hold it in the hand, it has to be cut open. Obviously, at that stage in the game, you're not using that one for your, you know, for your dalet minim. But you do have to make sure that the esrog is there. Now, the way to do that, practically speaking, is to make sure to be buying the esrog from a place that has a hechsher, from a recognized posek, someone who is able to tell you, I know that this is coming from a tree that is not, that was not grafted, and that is totally A-OK, pure esrog, unadulterated, raw, whatever you want to call it, extreme esrog. And if you got one of those, then you're going to be okay. First question, when a boy brings an esrog to Greenwald or myself and says, is this okay? The first question we're going to ask is, where is it from? The inevitable answer that people who are not listening to this comment, this sentence I'm about to say, the inevitable answer they're going to say is?
Over there.
From that one. That's not what we mean by where does it come. Where does it come from means, tell me what orchard did it come from? What hechsher does it have? Any stand that you're buying from should have, or that you're going to bring us an esrog from, should have a sheet of paper that says some kind of kashrus where the esrog comes from, and barring that, you cannot buy the esrog. Not everything that's being sold in any one given place is assumed to be okay. That you have to have that kind of hechsher. If it doesn't have, then you should not be buying it. Okay. Let's talk about a couple of common things about the Echsherim on the Esrogim, so we should know some ABC, you know, terms that are used. And again, these are going to come up, you know, that you're going to hear, so you do need to know this. When the Chazon Ish moved to Eretz Yisrael, wanting to mekayim, you know, the mitzvah, you know, properly, so he had taken great pains to travel up and down and left and right in the land of Israel and identify which, you know, trees, etc., were actual real esrog trees. Again, we know what esrog trees look like, right? They're all over the place, but point being, like, you know, show me a tree that we know was not grafted, was not genetically played with, and is just a regular pure esrog tree. Okay, there were trees like that the Chazon Ish felt were 100% totally untouched, that he had found also somewhere up north, right south, and what's this direction, east of Tzfat, to the right and down of Tzfat, and the Chazon Ish had brought back had purchased a branch of one of the trees, brought it back with him to Bnei Brak, gave it to a Talmud of his named Rabbi Yehuda Lefkovich, the Katzalik Devracha, and told him, here, this is an esrog that is not grafted, that is totally kosher to use, do you mind planting it and and you know, like grow an esrog tree. Rav Michal Yehuda, who at that stage was not yet the Rosh Yeshiva of the Panovich Yeshiva, had said to his Rebbe, like, I'm not a farmer, I'm an avreich in learning a kol, what are you talking about? And the Chazon Ish gave him a bracha. Trust me, it's not going to waste any time of yours. You put in the thing, you do your basic things you need to do, water, whatever it is, and you'll be mezakeh the rabbim with kosher esrogim, and it's a good thing to do. That's what Michal Yehuda did, and that esrog tree has given esrogim for many, many, many years on the Bnei Brak Shabbaton. You will get to see those esrogim trees that were there after Michal Yehuda was nifter. Actually, that first year, the esrogim did not give their esrogim, the tree did not give the esrogim the quantity that it had done in the past, which was a very unbelievable thing. The tree mamish had a bracha of the Chazon Ish, the Michal Yehuda would not have to waste time with it, and after he passed away, that bracha left. And from that tree, though, many, many, many others have taken esrogim and seeds and other little branches and planted them in esrog orchards in order. Remember, they weren't interested in making money. They just wanted to have kosher esrogim. They didn't mind giving out branches to the trees to others. And so one of the most common things that you'll hear about an esrog, that people will call this, is a Chazon Ish esrog. That expression just means is that the esrog there is from, like we learned in Bava Kamma, tolados, right? A seed from a seed from a seed from the tree that the Chazon Ish had planted there in Bnei Brak, to be used to be growing esrogim. Today there is hundreds, if not thousands, of Chazon Ish esrogim available on the market, but they all stem from that one thing. Those are, I don't want to say the best, but those are safe. And I don't mean to say they're not the best. What I mean is, I mean to imply that they're better than any other ones that are also okay. But those are common. Those are safe, and you should, in theory, be looking to get one of those. Yeah.
Does that have to show them and say they're causing this tree?
Meaning what?
The guy
who
says
you
got the
branch from Chazon Ish. So you have to see that there's a two that there has to be a heksha on this particular guy's stand, this person he has to be named by name, but this guy is selling is from this. Yeah. There are other like legitimate esrogim that are there, but like I said, in terms of things that you're going to find in the shuk, the Chazon Ish esrogim are definitely going to be the safest. The Badatz Eid HaCharedus has a different kind of esrog that they had used that many, many people still would use also, so that that would be assumed to be to be fine too. If you have the option of buying a Chazon Ish esrog, those are, like I said, those are definitely on the safer side. And again, you probably will encounter stands that the hechsher, the place that they got it from, is less than 100% clear and unquestionable. And those will tell you to send back and not use. From 25 shekel to what was that?
The average kosher.
It's hard to know because you really can get like a metzia. Like if you have good eyesight and and patience, you can I've had at times where one of my kids in particular has like a particularly good good feel. He pulled out a sorghum for like 60 shekel that people would easily sell for 300-400 shekel. What was that? Not sure. Yeah. Huh?
Interesting.
I guess it's a lemon, what I'm saying? Like it is like grown on a tree. It doesn't have like when you buy like lemons in the store, you don't spend all that much money on them. So okay, they do have to take care of them. It is a lot of work. It's not a simple thing to do. But at the end of the day, it's more surprising why an esrog could cost 1,000 shekel than it could cost 20 shekel. Right? Okay. So now that's in terms of the idea of a murkav and having a kasher, what's called a yichus, a genealogy on the esrog. Let's talk about anana. There was a question actually. Right? Did you? What was that?
Are all
chazon ish
esrogs still kosher? Are they any of them grafted? I mean, from because they're not natural being kosher, but are they
Yeah, they're not great. Anyone with a legitimate is not grafted. There have been like esrog merchants that were caught playing around with them, like were marketing, but those people were like There are people that are known to be, stayed away from, or that just don't really sell anymore because they were just like put out of business for playing around like that. The market is pretty, strict about that. If a person plays around, they'll get zapped, for that. there's another kind of esok called a disk and esok. My real disk and also had an esok tree that he liked to use. So you'll see that term. You won't see that so much in the shuk. Bradverman Esrog is another kind. Those are the three ones that will float around. Okay. Now, I'll talk about the anatomy of an Esrog a little bit, so we can just get the terms down that we're going to be using for the rest of the shiur. This page, okay. Number one, anatomy, the chotem. This is the most important part of the esrog over here at Tino. The chotem, again, these don't really have English translations, so we're not going to make any of them up. The chotem is, like we described, the area of the esrog where it begins to taper off up until the pitum of the esrog. So, for example, in picture of Mr. Esrog over here, you'll see there is an esrog, right? And then there comes a point where it starts to taper off, where it starts to get smaller. If you don't know what taper off means, okay, this entire area from here, from this line down, all of it and all sides of the esrog is called the chotem. Okay, that is the single most important part of the esrog in terms of many, if not most, of the halachas pertaining to an esrog. So it's very important to to keep that phrase in mind. The chotem of the esrog, the pitum of the esrog, that little thing, that little protrusion, that wood thing that grows on top, that we've all heard of. That's the least important part of the esrog because it very often doesn't exist and doesn't ever come up. The oketz is the stem on the bottom of the esrog. That's like the thicker little stem that's over here again. I'm just going to use that as a term later on. They're not that much actually applies to that. And then there's another phrase that you need to know that are called blitos and shkios. Blitos and shkios are, blita means a protrusion and a shkia means an indentation. For the esrog to be ideal, it's supposed to be very bumpy. Okay, a smooth esrog that's as smooth as an orange or a clementino, one of those kinds of things, is not so lechatchila and mohudar. Lechatchila has to have a lot of blitos and shkios. The more common expression that people use is that it has to have a nice gidol. A gidol means the way it grows. They want it to grow. A nice gidol means it's very bumpy and rough around the outside. Okay, now. So those are some terms and words that you need to know. Let's now run through some of the halachos. Color concerns. We're going to try to keep this politically correct over here. We love color, but on Esrogim we don't like all colors. And the rules are as follows. First color we're going to speak about is yellow and green. Yeah? Okay, if you're colorblind, by the way, you should be showing your esrogim to other people to watch, because you can miss certain things if you don't discern colors all that well. Now, the Mishabura brings, again, we're just going to speak about just straight halacha lemaisa and practical things. Mishabura brings that the esrog should not be totally grass green. Okay, now it should be partially yellowish, it should be getting yellow. The truth is, green is by itself is not. If the esrog was green, I'll explain what this means. It's going to sound obvious, but it's not obvious. Not so true. If the esrog was actually green, the esrog would be no good. But listen carefully. Most of the green esrogim that you see are not really green. How does that work? Green means if it's green and gonna stay green. But if it's not really green, it just hasn't gotten yellow yet, okay, then that's still a kosher type of an esrog. Okay? Now the problem is sukkahs is only 8 days long. Okay? So you don't always have the advantage of knowing what's gonna happen down the line. So you need to know a little bit about how the esrogim work to be able to project if your esrog is green or if it's really yellow. It just right now looks a little green. Got the idea? right? It is like a nice Erev Yom Kippur thought to be thinking. We have a lot of people who really are big tzaddikim, but just like right now, right, they're not really totally like that yet. So like, but they're going to get there, right? The same thing is true for an Esrog. The Esrog is really supposed to be yellow. Sometimes yellow Esrogim look green, but don't be tricked by that. Mishabura says, though, what you should try to have is that in order to actually know that that's going to be taking place, it's better to make sure that the Esrog is partially yellow. There should be some on the Esrog that you see that it's yellowing, and in that way you know that it's on the way to be, what do you call it, to becoming yellow. As I pointed out over here, common practice is not to be so makbid that the Esrog clearly be turning yellow. When the Esrog is a lightish green color, like we sort of know that the Esrog on the market, like that coming from the Esrog trees, are these species of Esrog that are yellow and like that. And because we so carefully monitor where the Esrogim come from, like that's part of the advantage of having this whole system of wanting to know the yichlus and what kind of Esrog is and, you know, where, like that. So we know that the Esrogim are real Esrogim that are going to be yellow. So if it is green right now, that would still be okay. Meaning to say, I say this clearly, if the Esrog has all of the other milas to it, if it like is really nice in all other ways and it's green, you should definitely take that. A green Esrog is like, not having a green Esrog is the least important thing that, you know, that's there, assuming that all the other things are met. If you can have an Esrog that's all the other milas to it and is also yellow, that would be great, but, you know, don't disqualify an Esrog just because it's green. What was that? So that's what I just said. So the answer is yes, but not at the expense of missing out on the hidurim that really, really count. So if your Esrog, if you have a choice of an Esrog that has other kinds of dots and things that we're going to speak about now, but yellow, and a pretty, pretty yellow, you have one that's green, 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 but is perfectly clean and has a nice giddle to it, you go for the green one, hands down. Nothing to talk about. But again, all things considered, right? If it could be yellow, so great. You should try to, you know, try to get one that is yellow. Okay. Next thing, and this is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly common: black dots on an Esrog or white dots on an Esrog. White dots are not that common. Black dots are. So we're always going to speak about the black dots from now on, instead of talking about the white ones, because you're really never going to see a white dot on an Esrog. Now, let's get some pictures of you, even though you think we know what black dots look like.
Why would someone go for a green?
Because they're more common than, it's hard to find yellow Esrog.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, bad. Yeah, don't do that. There are a couple of things you can do. There are a couple of things you can do to change the color of an Esrog. If you don't really know what you're doing, you will end up like messing up your Esrog like big time. Different kinds of apples can change Esrog colors. So if like you like know things, you can put your Esrog close enough in different boxes with different kinds of padding to in close proximity to apple, and it'll like change the Esrog color pretty quickly. But you can also like make it like purple if you do that, like which is bad. So you don't want to don't play games unless you like. What was that? Yeah, I guess it's not. There's no reason for it. There's no reason to do that. Okay. Now, let's speak about the black dots though. And the rules are going to be as follows. Okay, this is the most common issue with an Esrog, and I shouldn't say the most common. It's one of the most common issues with an Esrog, and it's a severe issue. And that is as follows: a black dot, if it's on the chotem of the Esrog, right, that top part of the Esrog that's tapering down, will passel the Esrog, period. Any visible, discernible black dot on an Esrog is going to passel the Esrog. That has to be checked. When you get an Esrog and you look at it, the first thing you're going to do is go over the chotem part in your hand. Keep looking around and around and from top to bottom of the chotem like that to make sure there are no black dots on the Esrog. There almost always is something that's there on the chotem. That's why you have to look very, very carefully. Now, black dots are only puzzle if they're visible with the naked eye, okay? And black dots are also only puzzle if they are black. But if black dots are really just very, very brown, dark brown dots. But with all due respect to the politically correct tape recorders over here, most people that are called, that used to be called black people, are not really black people, right? We know that? They're very, very dark brown. Correct? Okay. Now, the same thing is true when it comes to esrogim. The more and more esrogim a person learns how to expect and inspect, and you've had a shemush by Rabbanim, we have a shemush, etc., straight back till whenever it's been from Moshe Rabbeinu's time, know how to be able to look at a dot and know, no, this is not a black dot, this is a brown dot. Very often, okay, a boy will say, what do you mean? The esrog is pasul, it has a black dot on it, and the rabbi will say, no, it's actually kosher. It's not because he's crazy. If he knows what he's doing, that he looked at it carefully. If he tells you, no, this is not black, this is just a dark brown, that is going to be okay. Why are we mentioning it? So let's first speak about how to inspect the esrog, and then we'll talk about why that's such an important kudah to know. I mentioned over here that it's only going to be puzzle if at arm's length, if you hold the esrog about this far away, you can see that the black dot is there. If you need to look at it carefully to be able to see that there's something there, and you wouldn't notice it without holding it right in front of your eyes, you wouldn't notice it without looking with a magnifying glass, that is not going to puzzle the esrog. If you hold it at arm's length away, and you see it, and you say, hey, there's something there, okay, that's noticeable. Now, really, the truth be told, the blackness has to be noted from that far away also. Sometimes, like you see, like, yeah, that looks like a black dot. You might have to hold it a little closer just to get a better feel for the color. But when it's inspected, it's found to be not black, so then that would be okay. Now, that issue, though, is going to severely alter and affect the pricing of the esrog. Okay, if the chotim of the esrog is free from any kind of black or brown dots to it, right? That's much, much more mechuder. The expression he was called, if it's nucky, if the esrog is very, very clean, that's going to raise the price of the esrog considerably. Now, again, the esrog can still be kosher, it can still be mechuder if it has different kinds of brown dots on the thing, and that is very, very common that those like brownish dots be on the top of the esrog somewhere, and that's why you're going to have someone just tell you what color that actually is. Now, before we get to the questions, I want to finish up the black dot thing, and then we'll go on. There's one other instance where a black dot could passel the esrog. Again, on the chotem, the rule is any black dot, even one, as long as it's visible, that's going to make it passel. On the rest of the esrog, the black dots are going to passel the esrog if they take up the majority of the circumference of the esrog. Now, that sounds like it's a hard thing to do. There's black mamash, like a whole big thing around the whole, you know, the whole belly of the esrog. You're right, that is very uncommon to actually happen. What is not uncommon is what I pointed out in the last sentence over here, on the bottom part of the esrog, where the circumference is much smaller, right? Because the esrog tapers off in the bottom direction also. So if you know what the circumference is, right? Yeah. Right? So if at the circumference of the, like, I was about to pick up my cup and show you, like, and turn this to the side and show you this part, that would have been bad. So we can hold the cup up right now. This circumference is bigger than this one. We got that? Now, if this was an esrog, it could be only this big. It could be a little smaller, depending on the size of the fruit. So what happens at times, you can have a couple of, and the bottoms actually do get dirty. You can have a couple of black dots that are over here on the bottom, and they can actually take up the majority of the circumference, and that could also passel an esrog. So that has to be watched out for. Let's take questions at this point, and then we'll go on.
If it's on the bottom half, not on the top, not on the golden part, on the rest of this black dot, is it still wrong too?
Only if it takes up the robe of the circumference.
That one dot?
No, it can be a series of dots. No.
The series of dots takes up robe, otherwise it's okay?
Yeah, otherwise it's fine. Otherwise, it's fine. Again, one after the chodim is much more chavar. One little thing, boom, no
and,
good.
And do the chasim yish esrogs have pitums as well?
Some do, some don't.
For the black dots, are you able to, let's say, if you blow on it and it goes away, is that fine? Or like, can you put a pin to it?
A black dot is only a problem if the actual esrog is discolored. If you blow it away, to be the dust doesn't pass on esrog.
What about a pin or something, or your finger? pin, finger, fingernail?
If it's easily taken off, it's not. But you unless you have experience and practice with it, it's not a good idea to do, because you can scratch the esrog. You can actually make a real problem if you scratch the esrog into the skin. If you know how to do it, then it's not a big deal to do. It's actually really not a big deal to do, but just, you know, you have to be careful when you're trying to take off at that to see what it is. Yeah.
Is it a better move that when checking in to use a magnifying glass, it's kosher otherwise?
No, because even if you find something in a magnifying glass that wasn't visible with the naked eye, it doesn't pass it.
It's totally just saving level.
If it's not visible, it doesn't exist. It doesn't matter. Some people think that's true when it comes to God himself. That's not true. Even if he's not visible, he still exists. But when it comes to black dots on his rogim, if you can't see it, that's not there. Again, because it's not the presence of a dot that's wrong. It's the way the esrog looks. So looks means if you see it. If you don't see it, there's nothing not nice about it. Okay, moving along over here. One second. I'm going to speak about that later. Okay, the pitum part of the esrog. This goes very, very quickly over here, and that is like this. If the esrog grows without a pitum, so then the esrog is still kasher lichatchila. Nothing wrong with an esrog not having a pitum. Now, many, many, if not the bulk, the majority of esrogim that are available on the market do not have a pitum on the top, and that is totally fine. And the next bullet over, we pointed out, I'm not going to go through all of the. I'm going to read through it, but we're not going to go... We're not going to go crazy over here about this. But you have a couple of different scenarios and circumstances with a pitum falling off an esrog. Okay? You have like this. Number one, if the pitum totally fell off, meaning to say that the stem of the pitum becomes dislodged from the fruit part of the esrog, and now there's a hole in the top of the esrog where the pitum used to be, like a little piece in the wood was there, that is a problem. Okay? That is no good. If some of the stem is still going to be there, so that can be... That can be kosher with the evet if that's all you have. If the entire stem is there, but only the little bulb on the top, it's called the shoshanta, fell off. So it's recommended not to use. But bottom line is, it's still going to be okay without a problem. And again, it's very, very, very common, more often than not, to not have a pitum in the esrog. And the truth is, many people would prefer that, not to have to worry about any of these things getting chopped or broken or whatever it is. If you dafka always use the pitum and you really, really want one, so you know, look for an esrog that has one, and then you have to be careful with that. What? Well, okay. Not necessarily. No, not necessarily.
Is it cheaper with pitum?
What was that?
Not necessarily.
No. Like, no. You don't have to. You have to take a pitum.
Is a pitum cheaper if you have it on it?
No, not necessarily either. No. Okay. I pointed out over here that in numbers 2 and 3 of the two scenarios I just brought about a pitum falling off, if it's not the first day of Sukkot, so then there's like, you know, that, you know, to be makel about is really totally fine. Okay, now the next issue is a little bit more tricky over here, and that's called a chazazis. For lack of a better word, we're going to call the chazazis a wart. Okay, a wart on the esrog. And I have to show you some pictures over here, so we can see examples of what a wart, what a chazazis is. Hold on, because I'm not finding the pictures yet. Okay. If you have a wart, a chazazis on the chotem, the esrog becomes no good. Here's a very close-up picture of a wart. Okay? It actually looks like a wart. Okay? And that's why it's called that. Okay? Now, that's not so common, that the esrog just have, like, a thing sitting there in the middle. They actually have some really cool pictures of warts. Check this one out. Like, that's, like, really not common. That's why he made it to the book. That was, like, a cool picture of, like, an esrog. So that, if you see that, like, just stay away from that. Like, don't touch it. Like, you're going to get a disease or something. So that is not going to be good. Now, however, we have the following thing. we have the following thing. The basic rule that I just said, a wart, a chazazis on the chotem of the esrog pasels, a chazazis on the robe of the circumference of the rest of the esrog pasel, same as like the black dot thing. The theory is exactly the same. That doesn't come up all that often. What does come up is the question about a beletel. And what is a beletel? Okay. So, I think I tried to explain to you, a bletel, parentheses, a beige-brown splotch commonly found on an esrog. What is that? So, let's show you some pictures of bletelach. These are good words to know. What? This stuff over here, this little, how would you describe this? Give me a good word.
Scab.
No, but it's not a scab.
It's a problem around the
instrument. It means like a... Of course. Now, let me give you another use of the same word. When you make... Let's say making blintzes. Okay. What? When you put the little dough in the pan to make like the dough part of the blend, so that's called a bletel. Like, mommy makes the bletelosh. You make bletel. So, what does that have to do with this? Give me a good word. What? It's not the color. It's the
texture.
Sear?
Whatever it is, okay? This is a bletel. Now, you might, when you see a picture like this, you probably will say, oh yeah, I've noticed that like almost every esrog I see has, you know, there's a lot on this, okay? A lot of times esrog will only just have like a little thing like this on there. Like somewhere on the top, on the bottom, on the middle, all around the esrog, you'll have these little discolorations that are there on the esrog. Now, the Mishnah Berurah gives a rule. And then here's some other pictures of bletelach on an esrog. Extremely common. Extremely, extremely common. Totally, totally, massively, extremely common. Now, Mishnah Berurah gives a rule. It says as follows. If the bletel can be felt when your finger moves over the esrog, you know, if it's something that's nirgash biyad, you close your eyes, so like you don't really know what you're doing, you know, watching, and you just move your finger back and forth. If you feel that bletel there on the esrog, then has a din, a status of a chazazis. That's also called a wart on the esrog. If the bletel is so thin, okay, that when you move your hand over it, you don't really feel it. You just feel like an esrog, as far as you can tell, when you're touching and caressing the top of the thing, that is not considered a chazazis, and halakhically, like, doesn't exist, and it's totally fine, and not a big deal. Now, let's translate that into simple English.
Is it only a problem on the close arm or everywhere?
Let's translate that into simple English. Great question. So, since we mentioned that the rule was that a chazazis that's found on the chotem of the esrog, any chazazis found on the chotem, it will pass on the esrog. That means if you have a bletel like that, that's feelable, okay? That's noticeable. When you move your finger on the esrog, that's found on the chotem, the Mishnah Berurah holds that esrog is pasul. Okay, if you have beletelach on the robe of the circumference of the rest of the esrog, that could be no good. The same way we described before, that when you get to the bottom of the esrog, where the circumference is much smaller, okay, a beletelach, that's the plural, beletelach on the robe of the circumference of the bottom of the esrog will also passel. And here's where we have a little funny trick. And that is that the most common place for there to be lots of bletelach is the bottom part of the esrog, okay? Which can totally invalidate the esrog according to the Mishnah Berurah. Now, the... What was that? The rules are the same, right? The rules are the same. Now, the here's where we get a tricky thing. Only if it's on the robe of the circumference of the esrog. What was that?
It's said before that you have the same
thing
as chazazis, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, by the chazazis, it says that if there are two of them, then it passes the whole esrog. So wouldn't that also mean that if you had two bloodlots,
Only if they take up the robe of the circumference.
If there's one on the main part of the body, then it's fine, no?
So that should be clear. I'm sorry, you are right. If you have more than one feelable, noticeable bletel, that's out there, right? That will pass. So that can pass an esrog. Now, the truth be told, in the middle of the esrog, it's not so common to have that take place. That's why it's not, that part is actually not a common esrog. On the bottom of the esrog, it is something that's common. Be aware that not all of the posts can agree with the Mishnah Brura's assessment of the status of a bletel on an esrog. Okay, Mishnah Brura happens to be a bit on the machmir side here. There is a very, very popular and I will call well-founded school of thought amongst poskim that the bletel on an esrog are not considered a chazazis. That's just a natural part of the esrog, natural way that the esrogim grow, and those bletach will not invalidate the esrog. Again, the problem with the chazazis, the wart, was that's unnatural. That's like freaky, like to be there, right? So when I showed you the pictures of the real chazazios, where they actually like really did look freaky when you had those things like sticking out of like the middle of the esrog, that's a clear, hey, that doesn't belong. It's a fairly common thing that poskim would be makel, not like the Mishnah Brura, and say that since the bletlach are totally part of the natural growth of an esrog, oftentimes the bletlach grow because when the esrogim run, the esrog trees have thorns on them, which is like can be a little bit hard when you're working with esrogim. But a lot of times when the esrogim are bunched up next to each other, the thorn of one part of the branch will rub into a different fruit, and when it rubs into it a little bit, the esrog will pus like out of the thing, and that pus will form the bletlach. Okay, and since that's just part of the way they grow, many poskim are makel. So what that means is as follows. Okay, a person has every right in the world to try to follow the more stringent opinion here of the Mishnah Brura. Okay. If he wants to try to avoid an esrog without any bletlach on the top, on the bottom, great, and try to find, and again, so you can find, it's not so problematic to do, but those are going to be a little bit more on the expensive side. The lower-ended priced esrogim are going to be the ones that have the, have more bletlach on them. And again, you can have an esrog that like almost entirely looks like one big massive bletel. Like there's so many that like they're just such as like whatever. That's going to be like a very cheap priced esrog. One cannot claim that would be like mohudar because it's not. It actually looks sort of gross. But it could be kosher according to anyone who would not agree with the assessment here of the Mishnah Brura. And this is something that's an area that's going to greatly change and alter the pricing of the esrog. Okay, so that's something that you're going to have to see for yourselves. How much you want to be makbid about. Again, and many are makbid like the way the Mishnah Brura paskins that if the bletlach are noticeable, then you do have a problem, and you should try to avoid that. Let's make it clear. You should try to have an esrog that the Chavetz Chaim would have paskined, that is kosher. That's like not a bad thing to try to do, and that that should be attempted to happen on a lechatchila level. Okay. This is a much more common problem. Let's say last year when they were all esrogim from the Shemitah year, where the farmers weren't allowed to do any really work and they weren't allowed to protect the esrogim like that. The bletlach were a much more common phenomena on esrogim last year than they might normally be. It was harder. It was harder to find an esrog without bletlach last year than it is at other times, I should say. Okay. Let's move on over here. The next area is an area that I am not really going to talk about at all. Okay? And it's going to tell you that it exists and you should be aware. And if like you have any chashash that your esrog has any one of these issues, you definitely have to ask a question. The halachas are way too complicated to give over like in any organized, you know, clear kind of a fashion. The three psulim that he should be aware about. If it's nakuv, if the esrog has a hole in it, like a pin had you know, it popped into it. If there's a sedek, nizdak, a sedek means if it's cracked, so it can have that a pin popped into it, but it has any kind of a crack on the outside, or nikluf, if the esrog is peeled off, if some of the skin was peeled off the esrog. So for example, okay, obviously you would notice if your esrog like looked like a fruit, because there was like no skin on the outside, just so the fruit part, that avoid like the plague, okay? But sometimes it can happen the outer, more clear skin part of the esrog be peeled off, got scraped off a little bit. That could be no good. It could be good. That you again would have to ask, you know, someone who actually knows what they're looking at in order to determine. Sometimes people see things on an esrog that they think looks like the esrog was peeled off or as a whole, and it really doesn't. So again, someone knows what they're looking at should be asked to make that judgment call. Size. Okay, last thing that we're going to talk about before there are any questions. The size of an esrog. The rule is in Shulchan Aruch that the minimum shear of an esrog is that it should have the volume, not weight, but the volume of a kibetza. Okay? That's the size that an esrog should have. We gave you two opinions, once again, 57 grams or 100 grams, according to the Chazon Ish. You should not use an esrog that's less than 100 grams. Now, in theory, you want to try to take an esrog that's on the larger side, then you know that it's definitely over the shear. But if you have an esrog that's smaller and is like perfectly clean, has all of the nice bumps and all that stuff that an esrog should have, is shaped well, like looks like normal, it's just on the smaller side, so then that could be that you would take an esrog that small. You would have to weigh that. You would have to weigh and just make sure to take a food scale and make sure that the esrog is over 100 grams if you have any kind of stuffing about that. Yeah. And it's not uncommon, by the way, to have a small size esrog like that.
So will they or sell chazanish
esrog
in the
world? Because that expression chazanish just means like it came from the esrog tree. They try to be, it can be small, and they can shrink also. It is possible that an esrog be kosher the first day, still because it might the last day shrunk a little bit, just beneath, the line. It doesn't happen all the time, like at all, but definitely possible that happens. So if you're not sure, you definitely should be weighing. Yeah.
So like we mentioned before, if you get one that's not exactly 100 grams or 101, right, the first thing would be good, and they make a
There's what to talk about that. It's not so posh to do that at all, but maybe. Maybe. There's a general cloud when it comes to these kinds of things. If the mitzvah is rooted, if the mitzvah is really a mitzvah de araisa, even if at times it could only be the rabbanan, we don't use the suffix de rabbanan. Now, here in esrog, in the latter days of Sukkot, Bigvulim was never a mitzvah deraisa. It's really probably just it is just a pure, a pure derabanan. In all likelihood, you probably could be makel about that, if need be. But again, it's there is sort of pretty compelling reason to think that the Chazon Ish Shulam were pretty accurate. So it wouldn't be so simple to just like ignore that. I wouldn't know that, so just you can ask anything.
So let's say the Rambam so then
wouldn't
it be
mustard to say that? Correct. I can't say any. There's also sugi amongst the Rishonim, but many of the leniencies that you would have on the latter days of Sukkot would not apply if you're in Yerushalayim then, because of that. Yeah, it could be. It is totally fine. Yeah. Sure, forgetting anything? I think we pretty much have. Any general questions before we break? We're good to go. Okay, Gevaldik, Be'ez Hashem, let's go. Let's put this in practice.